new drama starring Bill Paterson, Nicholas Le Prevost, and Jonathan Pryce.
I'm so glad you haven't come to rake up the past, Ed, because that really would be quite pathetic.
I Remember You, this Saturday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday the 10th of February. This is Today with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning. The headlines today, Sir Keir Starmer has insisted he won't walk away from his mandate after facing down a call to resign from the leader of Scottish Labour. We'll speak to Ed Miliband, the Energy Secretary, after 8 o'clock. And Buckingham Palace has said it is ready to support the police as officers consider allegations about the conduct of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor.
Also in today's programme, the British Museum has spent £3.5 million to buy a Tudor harp pendant linked to Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. We'll speak with the museum's director about why it was all worth it. And Sir Michael Palin discusses his return to drama in the BBC's new series, Small Profits.
Homunculi. Tiny prophets who lived in great glass jars full of water.
Wait a minute, Dad. I remember this story. You used to tell it to me before bed. Little people in jars. But, Dad, I don't think it actually happened.
Oh, it did happen. I was there. I saw them. There were six of them.
Sir Michael will tell us all about those little people. That's all coming up after the BBC News is read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
Sir Keir Starmer appears safe in his job for the time being after surviving the most difficult day of his premiership so far. Yesterday, the Prime Minister defied a call for him to quit from the leader of Scottish Labour, Anas Sawa, and secured the backing of his cabinet, before telling a packed meeting of Labour MPs he was not prepared to abandon his mandate. Here's our political correspondent, Nick Eardley.
The public backing of every member of the cabinet means the immediate threat to Sir Keir Starmer has cooled. He told Labour MPs last night that he wasn't prepared to walk away, adding defiantly, "Every fight I've been in, I have won." Senior cabinet members told the BBC they thought yesterday's call from the Scottish Labour leader, Anas Sawa, for the Prime Minister to quit had actually galvanised support for Sir Keir, leaving him in a stronger position by the end of the day. A clear-out of senior officials is set to continue, with the Cabinet Secretary, Chris Wormald, also expected to leave his job in the coming days. But there is no doubt the Prime Minister has been wounded by recent events, in particular questions over his judgment in appointing Lord Mandelson as US Ambassador. Any sighs of relief may well be short-lived. The Prime Minister still faces potentially difficult moments ahead, including the Denton and Gorton by-election later this month and the Scottish, Welsh and English local elections in May.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who's widely tipped as a potential successor to Sir Keir Starmer, has revealed that last year he told Lord Mandelson he feared Labour was in big trouble electorally. Mr Streeting has published all their text exchanges from the past 18 months as part of an attempt to distance himself from the peer. Our political correspondent, Joe Pike, reports.
Mr Streeting said he was releasing the messages to dispel the idea that he had something to hide. Some of the exchanges are signed with a kiss. However, Mr Streeting has told the Guardian newspaper that he was not a close friend of Peter Mandelson. In one exchange from last March, the pair agree that the government is facing serious problems and is unable to articulate what it stands for. Mr Streeting says he's concerned that he could lose his own parliamentary seat, writing, "I fear we're in big trouble here and I am toast at the next election." These exchanges are likely to have been published anyway, since MPs have forced the government to release all contacts related to the disgraced former ambassador. But by publishing them now, Mr Streeting is trying to swiftly scotch any suspicions that his Mandelson links could ruin any future leadership bid.
Buckingham Palace says it stands ready to support the police if it's approached about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's conduct. Officers are assessing suggestions that the King's brother shared confidential reports from his role as the UK's trade envoy with the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Here's our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph.
These are charged times for the royal family. Thames Valley Police is now assessing allegations that in his past role as a UK trade envoy, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor shared confidential information with Jeffrey Epstein. The former prince has been contacted for comment. A statement released from the King's official spokesman last night described the monarch's profound concern at the continuing allegations around his younger brother's conduct. The statement also said that if approached by the Thames Valley Force, Buckingham Palace would support police inquiries.
Lawyers for Jeffrey Epstein's accomplice, Ghislaine Maxwell, have said she'll speak fully and honestly, but only if President Trump grants her clemency. The British former socialite is serving a 20-year prison sentence in the US for sex trafficking. She refused to answer questions from members of Congress during a virtual appearance before the House Oversight Committee in Washington yesterday, exercising her right to avoid incriminating herself. Her lawyers used the hearing to state there was no wrongdoing by either Mr. Trump or the former president, Bill Clinton. Both are mentioned multiple times in the Epstein files. The former Glamorgan and England cricketer Steve James and his wife Jane have warned that the condition that killed their daughter in 2020 is still not being properly recognised and treated. A BBC investigation has found sepsis awareness training is still not mandatory at most hospitals in Wales, as Wira Davis reports.
21-year-old Bethan James died 6 years ago after the Welsh Ambulance Service and the University Hospital of Wales in Cardiff failed to recognise and treat clear signs of sepsis. Bethan's parents, Steve and Jane James, have told the BBC they fear the same mistakes would happen today because of the patchy implementation of sepsis awareness training for all clinical staff. Time is critical in treating sepsis, and after the coroner in Bethan's case concluded she would have lived if her treatment had not been delayed, the Welsh Ambulance Service renewed its apology for errors identified in her treatment. The University Hospital of Wales said sepsis awareness and recognition are priorities, and it was continuously reviewing sepsis training.
A ransom deadline has passed for the release of Nancy Guthrie, the mother of the American TV news presenter Savannah Guthrie. The 84-year-old went missing from her home in Tucson in Arizona 9 days ago. A ransom letter was sent to several media organisations last week, containing a reported demand for $6 million in Bitcoin. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports from Tucson.
Shortly before the deadline, Savannah Guthrie issued a new video statement appealing for the public's help in finding her mother. She said the family was desperate and called the situation a nightmare. Such is her fame that the true crime story of a TV personality and her missing mother has generated thousands of calls to telephone tip lines. But despite a massive search of the area, the FBI has failed to identify a suspect. Savannah Guthrie and her family said at the weekend that they intended to pay the ransom, but the deadline passed with no word of Nancy Guthrie's fate.
David Willis reporting.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's see what the weather's got in store. As we were discussing yesterday, probably more rain. Sarah Keith Lucas.
You've guessed it. Yes, morning to you, Anna. You're still around 100 flood warnings in force across eastern Scotland, but the vast majority are across the Midlands, through the Severn Valley, down towards central southern England as well. And yes, there is more rain for some of us in the forecast today. For the southeast of England into the Midlands and eastern England, we'll hear a lot of low cloud, hill fog, drizzle here and there this morning. There will be spells of heavier rain intermittently for a time through today. Top temperatures, though, around about 11 or 12 degrees. Through Wales and southwest England, it is a cloudy morning. Few drizzly showers here and there, but some heavier rain will work into Cornwall later on this morning, pushing its way northwards and eastwards. Still plenty of showers into the afternoon, but a few brighter spells in between those showers too, and highs around 10 to 12 degrees here. Across northern England, northern Ireland, as well as southwest Scotland and northern Scotland, here too a damp grey day ahead. Bit of patchy rain this morning. I think it'll ease for a time later on. Temperatures reach around 7 to 9 degrees, but then the rain peps up again as we move into the evening. And lastly, eastern Scotland, here a Met Office yellow rain warning comes into force at 9 a.m. and runs all day. So the rain once again will be really persistent here. Snow just on top of the very highest hills across the east of Scotland. Could be 40 to 60 millimetres of rain, though, adding to the flooding problems. And top temperatures here around 6 or 7 degrees.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. It's coming up to 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers digesting the drama of politics yesterday. Cabinet bounced into giving PMs day of execution is the Daily Mail's headline. It says Sir Keir Starmer was rocked by the Scottish Labour leader Anna Sarwar's call for him to go. The Guardian says the Prime Minister has seen off an immediate challenge to his position, but has emerged badly damaged. A government insider tells The Eye that it will take the resignation of one cabinet minister to force the PM out. The Sun's editorial likens Sir Keir to Monty Python's Black Knight, but it says while the Prime Minister clings on, next to nothing is being done to fix Britain's broken borders. Flailing economy and clapped out public services. In its commentary, the Mirror says the Prime Minister held his ground, but the governing with a purpose must follow, the Express asks. Wouldn't it be more honourable to quit now?
The Daily Telegraph says Wes Streeting has been accused of orchestrating a leadership coup against Sir Keir. The Times quotes a minister as saying Mr Sarwar was Streeting's outrider. A spokesperson for the Health Secretary has denied any coup attempt.
The Mirror calls the King's offer to assist police with their investigations into his brother a royal bombshell for Andrew. The Sun says the statement is unprecedented. The Mail's commentary says the intervention is significant, but there is one word no one in the House of Windsor seems able to utter. Sorry. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has previously denied any wrongdoing.
The Financial Times says the US Embassy in London is denying visas over petty offences, in some cases going back to the 1970s. Lawyers say that executives are among those affected in what the paper calls a sign of how far-reaching the US anti-immigration drive has become. The State Department said it was upholding the highest standards of national security through the visa process.
And the Times brings you the news that you can now buy a former Royal Island for the price of a modest semi in the home counties. The paper says that Ynys Gyftan, which sits within the Snowdonia National Park, was once owned by Queen Anne, but could now be yours for a mere £350,000. It says while the island has no electricity, it does have a mains water pipe and a septic tank.
How to contain one's excitement. Everything you need right there, isn't there? It's 11 minutes past six now. Ghislaine Maxwell, the accomplice of the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, who is currently serving a prison sentence in the US, has refused to answer questions on the pair's crimes from members of Congress in Washington. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes has been telling me more.
She did appear before the committee. This is the committee investigating Epstein's crimes, as expected. She pleaded the fifth, exercising her right to avoid self-incrimination, after saying that she would like to answer the committee's questions, but on the advice of counsel, she said that she respectfully declined to answer. So it was a brief appearance, and for members of the committee, ultimately an unsatisfying experience. In the social media post, though, slightly earlier, Maxwell's lawyer, David Marcus, said that she was prepared to speak fully and honestly if granted clemency by President Trump. He went on, only she can provide the complete account. Some may not like what they hear, but the truth matters, he posted. Now, this has been put to President Trump in the past. He has said that he hasn't given it much thought, but he has never ruled it in or out.
Interesting. There's also been the opportunity for a small group of lawmakers to view the Epstein files unredacted. What's been happening with that?
Yes, now this is interesting because given the huge number of files, documents, photographs, and the fact that these members of Congress have to go into the Department of Justice by themselves, they can't have any electronic equipment, they can't have members of staff with them. So they are by themselves looking through these files. So potentially it's going to take them a very long time to go through them. But they have started that process. And, well, one Republican representative, Thomas Massey, says, and I'll just quote what he said. He said, I saw, this is what bothered me, he said that there were names of at least six men that have been redacted that are likely incriminated by their inclusion in these files. He said that's the first thing that he saw, and he said it took some digging to find those names. Another, a Democrat, Jamie Raskin, he has accused the Justice Department of making mysterious redactions to these documents that he says obscure the names of abusers. We've heard about this frequently over the last couple of days. And at the same time, of course, those redactions that many people say were unnecessary. And that's what he is pointing at here, saying that it is troubling to him that some areas are blacked out that he can see no justification for.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
It's coming up to 14 minutes past six now. A father and a mother who were told their daughter could have survived a fatal sepsis infection if only her condition had been recognised early, a warning that others will die unless something changes. Our correspondent, Wira Davis, has been speaking to the couple and investigating the cost to the country, as well as to so many families, of sepsis. Wira, tell us their story.
Yeah, well, look, as you say, sepsis, I know, is an issue we've covered on this programme. You talk about the cost to the country. You know, 50,000 people die in the UK every year from sepsis. It kills more than a lot of cancers combined. And I've been speaking to Steve and Jane James. Now, Steve, as it happens, is a former England cricketer. Jane is a health professional. They were both aware parents, but there was nothing they could do 6 years ago when their daughter Bethan fell ill very quickly over the course of a week. She was admitted to hospital. She had all the signs of sepsis. She had a score of 8 on the early warning system, but still, ambulance staff and hospital staff didn't recognise that she had sepsis until it was far too late. There was an inquest into her death, which said that she would have survived had those conditions been seen, had they been treated. But I've been speaking to the Jameses, and they say that they still, 6 years later, because of the lack of awareness, the patchy sepsis training for clinical staff across the UK, they say that if the same thing happened today, that their daughter Bethan would still probably die because of a lack of awareness among some medical staff
that word,
about the seriousness of sepsis.
That word patchy is striking. In other words, there is not just routine training for all NHS staff, and particularly ambulance staff, in how to recognise this.
No, not across the UK, particularly here in Wales. Only two of our health boards have got routine sepsis training for all clinical staff. It's slightly better in parts of England, but no means blanket. You mentioned ambulances. We know that antibiotics in ambulances can be critical in treating sepsis, yet only two ambulance services at the Isle of Wight and in Scotland do medics routinely carry antibiotics to treat sepsis. We've been speaking to the Sepsis Trust. That's something they'd like to see across the whole of the UK. And as I say, 48,000 people dying every year from sepsis, and time is critical. You know, an hour, 30 minutes, early recognition can save somebody's life. And it certainly wasn't the case in Bethan's case.
Wira Davis, thank you for that. We'll hear your report about the family and about the wider issues a little bit later in the programme. It's now 16 minutes past six. Would he stay or would he go? That was the question that was being asked in Westminster yesterday, but also, of course, in the markets, because when politics moves, Sean, the markets often move as well.
Yeah, and certainly in recent years, whenever we've talked about the future of whatever Chancellor it might be at the time or Prime Minister, we have noticed and seen the attention put towards these bond markets, so those investors around the world who effectively lend governments money and set the interest rate on the money that those countries borrow as well. So yesterday, the cost for the UK government to borrow over a 10-year period, that 10-year bond or gilt, within the day it rose from around 4.5% towards the end of last week to 4.6%. And then, as we got that support from the Prime Minister, from his cabinet throughout the day, that rate fell back down again to just above 4.5%. So some moves within the day. Jeffrey Yu, Senior Market Strategist for BNY, joins me now in the studio. Jeffrey, morning.
Good morning.
What did it feel like, those moves?
Well, it really felt like, you know, markets were, you know, tracking Twitter feeds and also just the newswires, you know, minute by minute, right? So the ticks were moving accordingly. You know, the scenarios were basically... Will things shift? Will policy change, especially on the fiscal side? And we have to bear in mind the global bond market is very, very sensitive right now to this notion of fiscal dominance, excessive fiscal spending. We're seeing Japan, seeing in Europe, you know, UK is being affected as well. So that clearly was a theme. But as you said earlier, towards the end of the session, you know, things calmed a bit and actually borrowing costs fell by session end.
So just to explain a little bit what these moves meant, because, you know, if we zoom out, these interest rates haven't changed that much over the last year or so, and they've been bouncing between a certain range. But when you see the move up and the move down yesterday, what are investors actually thinking at that point in time might happen?
So the scenario was basically if there is, you know, going to be a change in the path of fiscal spending, you know, in the country, and clearly they were pricing in more government spending at that point. That's what happens, you know, when yields rise, assuming everything else stays the same. And then that move was swiftly reversed, you know, when those messages of support came out from the rest of the cabinet.
And we saw sort of moves in the currency as well yesterday. Yeah. Where particularly did you see, against which currencies?
It was actually sterling versus the euro. You know, that's, you know, where markets were really pricing differentials because, you know, when you look at sterling versus the euro and euro against the dollar, that I think is more of international events or US interest rate expectations, you know, which will be, you know, subject to shifts as well. So currency markets view changes in euro against sterling, you know, as the best way to price tiresome fiscal differential, so to speak, because we know that the Eurozone, especially backed by Germany's much stronger balance sheet, seemingly is in a slightly better position, well, in a much better position right now. So that's what was being priced in, but those moves reversed as well.
And what do you think investors will be particularly looking out for now? Mm-hmm. Clearly, they're paying very close attention all by the minute to the words that are being said by politicians, but what exactly?
Right. Assuming we have the status quo right now, then the path ahead is, will there be changes in policy? Will government double down on their current fiscal plans? Will there be any adjustments? If we go back to the gilt yield, it's basically two components. One is fiscal path, and the second path is the second aspect is inflation. Now, by all accounts, as the Bank of England highlighted last week, inflation is probably going to come off. So that actually buys government some room as well. How do you use that room? I think that's what market investors, especially in the run-up until May, will be focused on.
Jeffrey, thank you very much for your time this morning. Might well come back to you on Greg's a little later if I've got a chance. But it's not gone unnoticed by business leaders and politicians in recent years that Manchester has outperformed much of the rest of the country. The wider Greater Manchester region, growing at more than double the rate the country has over the last decade. And apart from London, attracting the highest level of foreign direct investment as well. So to get into this a bit more, I caught up with a few bosses who themselves have seen their businesses grow quickly from their base there. Lawrence Newman is founder and chief executive of the maker of those LED face masks, Beauty Tech Group, now listed on the London Stock Exchange. On the Beach, the online travel agent, also listed on the stock market. Sean Morton, the chief exec there. And Emma Thackeray, who's the co-founder of the soft drinks company Hip Pop, which sells in supermarkets throughout the UK.
Just last week, we received some financial support from the Combined Authority, a loan from their, I think it's the GM Advance Fund, that's going to help our innovation and manufacturing capability under the arches in Manchester Piccadilly. And what that is going to do is going to help us progress a lot faster with a piece of ingredient and manufacturing innovation than we would have been able to do if we didn't have the money. So I think that's a really good example of how, as a local government, I guess, Manchester is investing in businesses and supporting businesses.
Interested. When, Lawrence, you talk about being listed on a stock market, was it last year that you listed on the...
Late last year.
How does that compare to what you have in Manchester?
Well, it's interesting listening to Emma talk about support. I think when I look at my journey, and I started the business back in 2009... I don't think there was too much support. So it's good to hear that there's upcoming help for maybe newer businesses. And actually, we struggled to raise capital in the early days. And I think everybody talked about growth. But what I learned was really they wanted profitability quite early on, which is very, very challenging for startup businesses.
When you say they?
Institutions and anywhere where you're looking to raise capital. Before I came on the programme today, I thought back to those days and was it beneficial that we were Northern when I went to see Northern funds? And I always thought, well, we're based in the North. You should be investing in us. But really, I think they always look beyond that and look at the business itself and whether it's got an opportunity, because there's always a high risk profile for a startup. So I think it's good to hear that you're receiving the sort of support that I think businesses in the Northwest should receive from local institutions.
Sean, why might that be? We talk about many of the positive aspects of Manchester's growth, but it sort of feels like there isn't that sort of large investment scene or as big as it needs to be for the likes of yourself and Lawrence.
There's still quite a big draw into London for these big institutions, and they do want to meet the people at the top of the corporate they're investing in face to face, and they want to do that regularly. So, I mean, fortunately, the transport down there is pretty straightforward going back and forth.
Would it make a difference if there was, I don't even know what this would look like, but when you go to London and you're then in this sort of infrastructure of financial support and investment, it's there.
Yeah.
What isn't here in Manchester?
Just think that the institutions that are deploying this capital into the stock exchange, they are in London. But I don't think that's a barrier for businesses based in Manchester accessing that capital at all.
And I think, look, we're talking about listed life, which might be different to a route that another business may go down. So if you look at private equity, you look about raising money with high net worths, might be. I think there is opportunities in Manchester for that. And I probably should have said in my early days, we ended up raising money with NVM, which is a Northern-based VCT fund. when we listed, I remember lots of the Northwest-based funds saying, oh, I wish I'd backed you now, looking at it, of course, because it's been hugely successful. And they came in high risk at the time and have done incredibly well being part of the journey. So we were backed eventually in the early days by a Northern fund. So the opportunities are there. I just think that they should be a little bit more aggressively looking at specifically backing Manchester-based businesses.
You can hear plenty more of that chat where they talk about, you know, the skills that the university bring and the clusters that have formed around Manchester in recent years as well on Wake Up to Money on BBC Sounds. Now, let's turn our attention to the struggles of weight loss drug maker Novo Nordisk. It's been reflected in the 50% fall in its share price over the last year. But in attempts to fight back a bit, it has sued the US firm Hims & Hers Health. It did this yesterday, and this is the company that launched and then abandoned a cheap copy of Novo's weight loss pill Wegovy over patent infringement. Kerry Fulford is a pharmaceutical analyst for Berenberg. Kerry, morning. What does this tell us about how the market for weight loss drugs is going at the moment?
Good morning. Yeah, I think it's telling you that there's still great excitement and demand for weight loss products. In the US, you mentioned Novo Nordisk, with its Wegovy pill, is the first company to launch an oral GLP-1. And so far, the prescription trends have been very encouraging. So, you know, we've had Hims on the market for a while now, making a copy of the injectable formulation of semaglutide. And it was a big surprise to see them start to move forwards with an oral version of the pill. But I think it's telling you the demand in the market is still incredibly high.
But given what has occurred here with them, you know, abandoning a cheap copy of it and concerns over, you know, who owns these patents and what they can do with them, is that going to impact the market at all?
I think it tells you, you know, this is the first move Novo is really making here to clamp down on this process of compounding. It is enabled in the US. It's illegal. Process when a product has been in short supply, which originally the injectable formulation of Wegovy was. But when the branded product was then in full supply, the compounding didn't stop. And that surprised many of us in the market. But essentially, I think this is Novo's way, firstly, of fighting back, making the compounded product obsolete with a pill that's a lot cheaper and actually cheaper than the compounded product. And now in a position where it needs to fight back from a legal perspective as well.
We'll see
if
it manages to do that. Kerry Holford from Berenberg, thank you. Jeff, just quickly, while I've still got you, Greg's share price fell yesterday because of these weight loss drugs as well.
Yes, and partially there's a view from one of our peers noticing, you know, 7% of UK adults, you know, use GLP-1 drugs right now. And also if prices for them may disproportionately affect customers of Greg's, you know, so that was one of the main reasons behind this. But I think all businesses, they need to realise that this is only going to become much more widespread. Overall, I think a healthier nation is a more productive nation, but I think business need to adjust to a new customer base accordingly.
Yeah, and we've seen the Greg's chief executive having to talk about doing that. Whether that will be enough to convince investors might be another matter. The share price falling 6% at one point yesterday. I'll be back after 7 o'clock.
Such an interesting change, isn't it? 28 minutes past six. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Jeff. Carthy's here with the sport.
Morning. Thank you very much. Fourth place, a very familiar finish for Great Britain's Winter Olympians yesterday. Kirsty Muir finished in fourth in the freestyle skiing women's slopestyle final. Mia Brooks just missed out on a podium finish in the snowboard big air final after a brilliant trick featuring 4.5 rotations in the air. Her heel edge caught in the snow as she landed, but she was delighted for her opponents.
We're all friends, we're all stoked for each other, and yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, obviously in the competition you're like, oh my god, like I want to land this trick, and oh my god, like why did she land that trick and I need to land this, but like honestly at the end of the day you're just like, you know what, we've all worked equally as hard to get here, and yeah, we're just stoked.
Bruce Mowat and Jen Dodds topped the table after the round robin stage of the mixed curling, but they lost their semi-final 9-3 to Sweden.
Gutted is probably the word just now. I think personally for me that was probably my worst game of the week, so it kind of put us on the back foot from the get-go, and the Swedish just capitalised on that, and they played really well tonight. Obviously really disappointed just now, but going to pick ourselves up, there's still a medal to be won.
Mowat and Dodds compete in today's bronze medal match, hoping to go one better than at the last Winter Olympics when they lost that match and then finished in fourth. Lila Fear and Lewis Gibson began their campaign to win Britain's first figure skating medal since Torvald and Dean. They are currently in fourth place after the rhythm dance. That event concludes tomorrow. To cricket, and the Pakistan government has ended its order on a boycott by its T20 cricket team after a 10-day standoff at the World Cup. Pakistan have now agreed to play their T20 World Cup match against India at the weekend. The biggest and most lucrative fixture in the sport had been in doubt, but there was a frenzy of activity last night to get the game back on, as Stefan Schemmelt reports.
The Pakistan government asked its team to boycott Sunday's game, and it is the government that has cleared the path for it to now go ahead, with a statement released on Monday. The statement references friendly nations, Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, but there's no mention of India. It's unclear what the lasting damage would have been had cricket's biggest game not gone ahead. The financial impact is a given. Perhaps this is a shift from the total power held in India. For all of its wealth, influence and fan base, India still needs opponents, especially Pakistan at a World Cup.
Well, Pakistan are involved in today's games at the T20 World Cup. They play the USA later. All matches have commentary on Five Sports Extra.
Thank you, Carthy. 6:30 next Monday, Radio 4 begins a new investigation.
What happens when someone's personality changes completely?
That's not Dad. There's something else that's gone on there.
I'm Noel Titheridge, and in a new series for Radio 4, I explore how medications prescribed to treat movement disorders like Parkinson's and restless leg syndrome have been linked to profound impulsive changes in behaviour. If these side effects can destroy relationships and even lead to criminality, why weren't some patients and families warned?
How much had I known him beforehand, and how much had I not known?
Impulsive starts next Monday afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Time now is 29 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson, and Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
Labour MPs have rallied round Sir Keir Starmer after his most bruising day yet as Prime Minister. Yesterday he faced calls from the Scottish Labour leader to resign. But addressing members of the parliamentary party in Westminster last night, Sir Keir said he wouldn't walk away from his mandate. This morning the Prime Minister will host a cabinet meeting in Number 10. He's also facing having to further rebuild his team of senior officials, with the Cabinet Secretary Chris Wormald expected to leave in the coming days. The Health Secretary Wes Streeting has published text messages he sent to Lord Mandelson, who was sacked as the ambassador to the US. Mr Streeting, who's widely tipped as a future successor to Sir Keir Starmer, insisted they were not close friends. Buckingham Palace says it stands ready to support the police if it's approached about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's conduct. Officers are assessing suggestions that the King's brother shared confidential reports from his role as the UK's trade envoy with the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Mr Mountbatten Windsor has been approached for comment. The former Glamorgan and England cricketer Steve James and his wife Jane say they fear there'll be more deaths from sepsis, the condition which killed their daughter, because of the patchy implementation of training in hospitals. A BBC investigation has found that sepsis awareness training is still not mandatory at most hospitals in Wales, and only a small number of ambulances in the UK carry potentially life-saving antibiotics for the condition. The Welsh Government said it was taking steps to improve how the NHS recognises and responds to sepsis. A deadline has passed for a ransom demand in return for the release of the mother of the American news anchor Savannah Guthrie. Despite a huge search in the area in Arizona where the 84-year-old Nancy Guthrie went missing 9 days ago, police haven't identified a suspect. Shortly before the deadline, Savannah Guthrie said her family had reached an hour of desperation.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. Now 27 minutes to 7. I've won every fight I've been in, Keir Starmer told Labour MPs last night at the end of a very long day in which there certainly was a big fight, and he did appear to win it. Our chief political correspondent Henry Zeffman joins us. Why, I guess, is the question for many listeners. Henry, what changed during that day?
Well, I think a lot of senior people in the Labour Party and influential people in the Labour Party looked over the edge yesterday and decided, no, not now. I mean, we got to a position yesterday, Nick, where Keir Starmer was living hour by hour. But he had a few great hours in the afternoon And I don't think that's won him job security, but it has won him the ability to live day by day, at least, again. I mean, yesterday morning, when the Director of Communications followed the Chief of Staff in leaving, there was a sort of feeling of who is left in there in Downing Street. But actually, those who were left in there in Downing Street had an incredibly successful political effort. I'm told they gathered in the Cabinet Room, turned it into a so-called war room to save Keir Starmer's premiership, and they did save it. I mean, the crucial moment came at about 2:30 in the afternoon, and not because that's when Anas Sarwar stood up to call for Keir Starmer to go, but because that's when David Lammy, the Deputy Prime Minister, became the first Cabinet Minister, after a period of pretty conspicuous silence on the Cabinet's part, to say that Keir Starmer must stay on. And then you very quickly got into a position where all of the Cabinet had to demonstrate loyalty and make a choice. And they made the choice to keep Keir Starmer. But I think it is important to say that while in many cases, yes, it is just as simple as people in the Cabinet and Labour MPs meaning what they say and thinking it would be mad to change leader, there are others who are pretty clear in private that they are reserving their position. They are reserving their position until the May elections, which just become even bigger in political significance now, or even perhaps in some cases, just until the Gorton and Denton by-election, which is a fortnight on Thursday.
But there has been real change now, change already, hasn't there? When you ask the question who is left in Downing Street, not only is the Chief of Staff gone, the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, not only is the Director of Communications left, but it looks as if the top civil servant, the man only recently appointed to try and get things in better shape, the Cabinet Secretary, might be leaving the door as well.
He is leaving. That may well be announced today. This is Chris Wormald. And I'm very conscious that he doesn't give interviews. He's not a politician. He can't answer for himself. There is a bit of a disparity there. But what I have to tell you is that within days, literally days of his appointment as Cabinet Secretary, as head of the civil service in December 2024, people at the top of government were expressing pretty severe reservations about him, and actually no small amount of bafflement at their own boss Keir Starmer for having picked him from the four-person shortlist. I mean, there was always an uneasy fit between Keir Starmer saying he wanted to rewire the state and appointing the longest serving permanent secretary to the top job running the civil service. Now, there's some suggestion that the pretext for his departure will be issues with the vetting process for Peter Mandelson, but Chris Wormald's appointment as Cabinet Secretary only happened 4 days before Peter Mandelson was announced as ambassador. And look, of course, Keir Starmer will know that having lost his Chief of Staff, his Director of Communications, and now his Cabinet Secretary and plenty of others too, all the attention is now going to be on the person who made those appointments, that's him, to make things work.
We'll be hearing from Ed Miliband a little bit later about what might change under this new administration. And in many ways, it is a new administration there in Downing Street. Henry Zeffman for now, thank you.
It's 23 minutes to seven. The King has said that Buckingham Palace stands ready to help the police, if approached, to help the investigation into the links between Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The Prince and Princess of Wales also released a statement in support of Epstein's victims yesterday. Well, Prince William is visiting Saudi Arabia at the moment to strengthen ties with the UK government, and our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph is there. Daniela, before we talk about that visit that you're on, this statement from the King, interventions like this are very rare from Buckingham Palace.
They're extremely rare, Anna. It was very much an unexpected intervention from the King yesterday. We hadn't actually heard anything publicly about his thinking since October, when he stripped his brother of all his royal titles and status and said then that his sympathy was with Epstein's victims. So last night's response was in response to new allegations and the complaint to Thames Valley Police about whether Andrew Mountbatten Windsor had passed confidential trade information to Jeffrey Epstein. And in light of those new allegations, Buckingham Palace clearly felt that this was the moment to step in again and voice the King's concerns. And what is clear from that statement delivered by the King's official spokesperson is the monarch's own personal frustration and upset at what he describes as his brother's conduct. And also laying out publicly that if the police require support from Buckingham Palace in any investigation they do into allegations against the former prince, then they're going to get it. Now, maybe that seems obvious, but to put it on the record from Buckingham Palace, to say it out loud, makes it explicitly clear the mood around Andrew Mountbatten Windsor at the palaces.
And Daniela, as we were saying, you're in Saudi Arabia with Prince William. We were talking yesterday about the potential controversy attached to that trip, given the kingdom's human rights record. I can only find a picture of Prince William and Mohammed bin Salman on one of the front pages this morning. They're shoulder to shoulder on the front of the Times. How will the palace feel that that visit is going?
I think there will be a degree of disappointment that perhaps the way the Epstein story is playing out has removed some aspects of the prince's trip to Saudi Arabia off the headlines. I mean, you know, of course, Kensington Palace were the first ones to issue a statement yesterday ahead of Prince William landing in Riyadh. So they would have been well aware that perhaps that would have shifted the focus slightly. But they felt ahead of this trip that they needed to say something on the record about Epstein, because the entire 3 days here in Saudi Arabia was at risk of being completely ambushed. But last night, a key moment in this trip, Prince William met the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. They had a private dinner, a private meeting. We're told they discussed a number of aspects of the relationship between the UK and Saudi. And Prince William also gifted Mohammed bin Salman an England football shirt.
Daniela Ralfos, Senior Royal Correspondent in Riyadh. Thank you.
It's now 20 to 7. The mother of a TV news anchor is kidnapped. The hostage takers demand millions in ransom. Not the plot of a new TV drama, the grim reality facing Savannah Guthrie, whose mother Nancy has now been missing from her Arizona home for more than a week. As our North America correspondent David Willis told me, the deadline for the ransom to be paid has now passed.
It has indeed. It passed several hours ago, Nick, and Savannah Guthrie said over the weekend that the family was willing to pay that ransom. A short while ago, the celebrity news website TMZ, which was one of the news outlets that received the ransom email a few days ago, said there was no sign, no recording of a payment to that particular Bitcoin address. So we really don't know, is the simple answer, whether that ransom has been paid. A previous deadline came and went last Thursday. This one was said to be more consequential. We don't know precisely in what way, but the next few hours will be utterly agonizing, I imagine, for the family as they wait to hear whether there'll be any end to what's been a very painful public ordeal.
What they do know is that Savannah Guthrie's mother, 84-year-old Nancy, is alive, is apparently well.
That certainly is Savannah Guthrie's belief. She posted a video to her Instagram account, Nick, about 3 hours or so before the ransom deadline. And you can see the pain, the desperation etched in her face. And in it, she says that we are at an hour of desperation and we need your help. That's the appeal, an appeal to the public. And she goes on to say that she does believe her mother is still alive. And that ransom is reported to be almost amount to around $6 million in Bitcoin. Savannah Guthrie having said at the weekend that the family will pay it, but so limited has been contact between them and the kidnappers that neither Savannah Guthrie and her siblings or the FBI have been able to establish for certain that the people who claim to be holding Nancy Guthrie captive are in fact doing so and that she is actually still alive.
David Willis, our North America correspondent, thank you for bringing us up to date.
It is 17 minutes to seven now. As another dramatic day unfolded yesterday in Parliament, a cabinet minister came to the Commons to tell MPs that the government would tighten up standards and vetting procedures in the wake of the Peter Mandelson affair. Alicia McCarthy reports.
Westminster had only just drawn breath from the weekend's news that the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, had resigned over the appointment of Peter Mandelson as the UK's ambassador to the US, when it was announced that the PM's Head of Communications, Tim Allen, was also quitting. And then Scottish Labour leader Anas Sawar called for Sir Keir Starmer himself to go. As journalists, pundits and politicians struggled to keep up, the Cabinet Office Minister Darren Jones came to the Commons with a plan.
I'm here today, Mr. Speaker, to update the House on further action the government will take to rebuild trust in public life in the wake of these damaging revelations since my statement last week. I'll finish the statement first, if I may.
Of course, it wasn't Darren Jones Conservative MPs wanted out the door, but they carried on heckling the minister as he explained there'd be a review of the rules around declarations of financial interests and into the use of what he called non-official communications channels, following accusations that Peter Mandelson had leaked sensitive government information to convicted paedophile and multimillionaire financier Jeffrey Epstein.
There is a lack of clarity about the use of non-corporate communication channels within government, which has raised concerns about the security of official information. As members on the benches opposite know from their former ministers, who also forwarded information from the government via private email accounts to people when they shouldn't.
But the Shadow Cabinet Office Minister, the Conservative Neil O'Brien, said the Prime Minister's authority was gone.
The Prime Minister was warned about Mandelson. He knew, but he decided it was a risk worth taking. And as the leader of the Scottish Labour Party pointed out today, it's not just the Mandelson affair. Time and time again, the Prime Minister gets it wrong.
For the Lib Dems, Lisa Smart agreed there needed to be tougher standards, an end to government by WhatsApp, and a way to boot out peers who broke the rules.
From Partygate to ministerial co-breaches that went unpunished, we have witnessed a systematic deterioration of standards and the current system is broken.
A Conservative, Esther McVeigh, turned to the resignation of the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney.
Why is it that the adviser who suggested Peter Mandelson as the ambassador to the US has had to resign, but the person who actually appointed Peter Mandelson, that is the Prime Minister, is still in post?
Darren Jones said Keir Starmer had apologised for appointing Peter Mandelson and repeated the Prime Minister's comment that
had the information that is now available had been available at the time of his appointment, he wouldn't have appointed him in the first place.
That's embarrassing, shouted Tory MPs. Another Conservative, Katie Lamb, called it insulting.
The first time, though it was not to be the last time, that Peter Mandelson resigned in disgrace from a Labour government, then Tony Blair's cabinet, I was 7 years old. Yeah. Is the minister seriously telling us that our Prime Minister needs tweaks to process to know not to hire somebody who has been a nationally notorious crook for over 25 years?
Secretary. As the Honourable Lady will have heard, if the Prime Minister had access to the information we now have about the depth and extent of the relationship between Jeffrey Epstein and Peter Mandelson, he would have not been appointed in the first place.
Labour's Sam Rushworth backed the minister's announcements.
It is refreshing to see a government that's committed to making those in positions of trust accountable.
Several MPs, including Labour's Luke Charters, reckoned Peter Mandelson should have to give back the payoff, reported to be up to £55,000, which he received when he was sacked as UK ambassador to Washington.
Peter Mandelson should be forced to pay every single penny back to the British people.
Chief Secretary.
I do agree with my honourable friend, and as I say, the Foreign Office will be coming forward with more information in due course.
The SNP's Pete Wishart said the Prime Minister had lost public trust.
He knows, everybody in this house knows, everybody in this country knows, he is toast. Why don't they just get on with it and get rid of him?
But at the end of just over an hour in front of MPs, Darren Jones concluded,
the Prime Minister, as he said today, is getting on with the job of delivering change for this country that the electorate voted for 18 months ago, rewarding my party with a huge majority in this House. These issues are important and we will fix them, not least keeping the victims of sexual abuse and abuse of power at the centre of those thoughts.
And he said he was sure that all MPs would want to work together on that.
Alicia McCarthy reporting there on events yesterday in Parliament.
Taking a look at the papers this morning, many of them dominated by politics, but also that story, as we were saying, that rare and really pretty extraordinary statement from the King yesterday about what he could do and what the palace could do to help police features strongly. Palace ready to work with police over fresh Andrew allegations, says the front of the Daily Telegraph this morning. It is the front page headline for both The Mirror and The Sun. The Mirror says King will help police, will help cops on Andy, says The Sun. And they reflect the fact that that statement by King Charles talked about profound concern about the allegations against the now Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. We're going to talk more about this. We'll speak to a former press secretary to the Queen at 8:10 this morning.
Another striking royal image on the front page of the Times, which is Prince William standing alongside Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. If that had been a politician, there would have been quite a lot more fuss. I wonder if one will follow. But it is the politics that dominates the front pages. And in a sense, which paper you read gives you a sense of the different angles. One angle is the fight that Keir Starmer displayed in his speech to Labour MPs yesterday. So that in The Guardian, "I'm not prepared to walk away," it quotes the Prime Minister as saying to his MPs. "PM comes out fighting" is the Times headline. The Mail chooses instead to highlight on what it says is the Cabinet being bounced its word into giving the PM a stay of execution. "Mercy of Cabinet keeps Starmer in Paris," how the Eye puts it. And the Telegraph has Streeting, where Streeting, the Health Secretary, being accused of a number 10 coup. Now, those of us of a certain age, Anna, spent much of yesterday thinking of another failed coup attempt against another Labour Prime Minister. Gordon Brown, back in 2009, I was political editor of the BBC at the time, where James Pennell resigned from the Cabinet saying the PM's got to go. And everybody expected David Miliband to follow him. And then Gordon Brown would have gone. And the truth is, the big question today is, who did Anas Sarwar believe would follow him? Because he sure as hell didn't expect to be out there on his own.
This is it. It requires, once you go over the top, it requires others to follow.
Yeah, and it might not have been a cabinet minister yesterday. People from Number 10 are suggesting that it was meant to be Wes Streeting. Wes Streeting's people are denying it, but it could have been a string of junior ministers, or indeed there was speculation that the Welsh First Minister and indeed the Mayor of London were going to call for Keir Starmer to go. Both of them have given their support to the Prime Minister. But we are, throughout the coverage of this story, going to add the words, "for now." Talking of which, at 10 to 7, let's talk to one of those Labour MPs highly critical of Keir Starmer in recent days and recent weeks, Carl Turner, Labour MP for East Hull, who was in the room where we're told, Mr. Turner, Keir Starmer made one of the speeches of his life. Is that right? Is that why he's still in his job?
Well, good morning, Nick. Thanks for having me on. Highly critical of the Prime Minister, only on the policy of jury trial curtailment, I might add.
Yeah, you didn't threaten to trigger a by-election to embarrass him. So you were mildly critical.
Well, I never said it for that reason. And the last time you had me on the programme, you said I was only qualified because I had a law degree, but Sir Brian Leveson knew everything. But anyway, we are where we are, Nick. We learn from the mistakes we make, don't we? And I think that's what the Prime Minister is learning from. There's no question that the Prime Minister has to be reflective. He has to make the apologies to the MAP Parliamentary Labour Party that he made last night. The reality is this, look. He's been shackled to Max Sweeney for too long. And the truth is, he's taking poor advice from him.
Do you think he's liberated? We heard one.
And he's moving forward now to run the country. We've got a majority in the Commons of 169. It's a joke, in my view, to say that the Prime Minister has to go anywhere. And I'm disappointed that Anas, who I think was acting on his own, not with others, with the intention of toppling the Prime Minister, acting on his own for his own self-interest, that's what was happening, because he thinks he needs to divorce himself from the Prime Minister in order to win Holyrood. It's a matter for Anas. He's got to answer those questions himself.
Well, indeed.
We hope to put them nowhere.
Now, give me a chance to ask you a question, if you will, because you used that striking phrase that he was shackled, the Prime Minister, to Morgan McSweeney. I was struck by one Labour MP who told our colleague Nick Watt of Newsnight that the Prime Minister appeared to be liberated yesterday. Is it your hope that without Morgan McSweeney, who in many ways is a product of the kind of new Labour type of thinking, without the influence of Peter Mandelson, without Tim Allen, who used to work for Tony Blair all those years ago and became Director of Communications for Keir Starmer, are you hoping that the Keir Starmer is liberated to be the more, is this the right phrase, left-wing individual you believe him to be?
Well, I think the PM is on the left of the Labour Party, but I think he's also determined to deliver for the British public, is also a pragmatist. And that's what I expect him to be doing. I think he was a different man yesterday when we saw him. He was strong, he was determined, he was reflective, he was apologetic. But let me tell you this, that was not a man who is on his knees. He was determined to stay where he is for the betterment of the British public, and that's what we expect him to do. And I tell you, he'd be letting the Labour Party down if he did anything other than stand in stand firm and do the job that the country expects him to do.
Yeah, I hear you, Mr. Turner. I promise you I do. But the likes of you and I because I'm paid to, and you because it is your vocation, obsess about these kind of phrases, the language of politics. People listening just want to know what it means to them. Do you believe that Keir Starmer will now do different things than he would otherwise have done as a result of the drama of the last 24 hours? And in which case, what?
Well, I think he has to be, I think he has to include the Parliamentary Labour Party more than he ever has done. You had me on the programme more recently about jury trial curtailment. The reality is there was no pitch rolling. I'm the guy who knows more about that issue than anybody else in Parliament, thank you very much. It's not just because I've got a law degree, it's just because I'm an expert, frankly. Mm. So if they'd have been consulted on that issue, we wouldn't have been in the mess we're in several weeks ago, and the mess we're in probably on the issue going forward until the government decides to put it in the bin where it belongs.
So more consultation and less doing whatever you like. Mr. Turner, Carl Turner, thanks for coming on at short notice to talk to us here on Today. And I stand corrected as ever.
Let's talk about the South Bank Centre, the imposing piece of 1960s architecture on the Thames, which has finally been given a Grade 2 listing. It's the iconic example, really, of British brutalism, isn't it? It was once voted the country's ugliest building. Catherine Croft is director of the 20th Century Society. Morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
I said finally because this has been going on for years. They just didn't want to list it.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's 35 years since it was first put forward for listing. So we've been campaigning for you know, it's our longest running campaign ever, I think. So, yeah, it's fantastic to have it finally recognised as the really important building that it is.
Did they hold out for so long because of, I mean, let's be blunt about it, because it's ugly, because it's not as beautiful as so many of the listed buildings that we're used to seeing?
Well, I don't think it's remotely ugly.
I know. But they were less keen. It's important. This is the thing. I mean, beauty and importance are sometimes two different things.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think it is an extraordinary sculptural bit of architecture and I think incredibly sophisticated and successful. But I think that, I mean, both 20th Century Society and Historic England have really been very consistent in saying that it's a fantastic building of architectural and historic interest and should be listed. But we've had the government department have been rejecting that advice. Over the years, I think probably under pressure from the building's owner. And I think it is that building owners still sometimes feel that listing restricts them in what they want to be doing. Mm. You know, that it's about stopping alterations rather than actually appreciating buildings and making sure that they change, kind of really capitalising on what makes them really good.
Yeah. Catherine, just as a final little thought, when you stand and look up at it, what is it that you love about it? Where do you see its beauty?
I think just the sheer kind of virtuosity of it, its composition. There's so much going on. You can kind of begin to work out and guess what's going on inside and work out how it all fits together. And it's both the spaces that you inhabit inside, but also the really sophisticated servicing of the building that's kind of expressed sculpturally on the outside. And it's beautifully crafted as well. I mean, it's easy to dismiss concrete as being crude and ugly, but actually there are lots of different ways that concrete's used at the South Bank Centre, both ones that are cast in situ on the site and panels that were made off-site and brought together. You know, the whole thing was incredibly well thought out and constructed.
Yeah, who could not be won over by your enthusiasm? Catherine Croft, thank you for joining as Director of the 20th Century Society.
Skis cutting through snow at breathtaking speed. Snowboards spinning in ways never seen before. Skeleton sleds pushing the limits. Making history, breaking records, and taking home gold. Trails will blaze. The Winter Olympics. Watch live on BBC iPlayer.
Let's check the weather with Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, Anna. Well, it's another cloudy day out there. So a lot of hill fog, mist, drizzle around this morning and more outbreaks of rain for some of us. Now, today across the southeast of England into eastern England and the Midlands, we're starting the day with a lot of low clouds, some hill fog and some drizzle. As we head through into the afternoon, some heavier spells of showery rain at times, but equally a few brighter intervals just breaking through the cloud too. And top temperatures around 11 or 12 degrees. For the southwest of England and Wales today, cloudy and drizzly to start. But there'll be heavier rain pushing into Cornwall over the next few hours, heading its way northwards and eastwards. So still plenty of heavy showers into the afternoon, particularly across Wales, but also a few brighter spells developing in the southwest, 10 to 12 degrees here. For northern England, Northern Ireland, southwest Scotland and northern Scotland, damp and grey. Patchy rain this morning, easing a little later on, but then the rain peps up once again into the evening hours and temperatures will be around 7 to 9. For eastern Scotland, lastly, another wet day. A yellow warning comes into force at 9 a.m. for more rain, and that runs all day. Could be another 40 to 60 millimetres, ongoing flooding possible here. Top temperatures around 6 or 7 degrees. It does turn a little colder and drier, but not until the end of the week.
Thank you very much indeed, Sarah. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 10th of February. The headlines this morning. The Prime Minister has told Labour MPs he is not prepared to give up his mandate to govern, despite being urged to quit by the leader of Scottish Labour. Buckingham Palace has said it is ready to support the police as officers consider allegations about the conduct of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And a ransom deadline has passed for the release of the mother of US television presenter Savannah Guthrie, who disappeared last week.
Also coming up this hour, sepsis is one of the biggest killers in the UK, but we will hear the story of, the warning of, a family whose daughter died after it was not recognised and not properly treated. And Sir Michael Palin will join us to discuss his triumphant returning to acting in the BBC's new series, Small Profits.
Homunculi. Tiny profits are lived in great glass jars full of water.
Wait a minute, Dad. I remember this story. You used to tell it to me before bed. Little people in jars. But, Dad, I don't think it actually happened.
Oh, it did happen. I was there. I saw them. There were six of them.
The Little People and Sir Michael, coming up all after the BBC News, read by Caroline Nichols.
Sir Keir Starmer appears safe in his job for the time being after surviving the most difficult day of his premiership so far. Yesterday, the Prime Minister defied a call for him to quit from the leader of Scottish Labour, Anas Sawa, and secured the backing of his cabinet before telling a packed meeting of Labour MPs he was not prepared to abandon his mandate. Here's our political correspondent, Nick Eardley.
The public backing of every member of the cabinet means the immediate threat to Sir Keir Starmer has cooled. He told Labour MPs last night that he wasn't prepared to walk away, adding defiantly, "Every fight I've been in, I have won." Senior cabinet members told the BBC they thought yesterday's call from the Scottish Labour leader, Anas Sawa, for the Prime Minister to quit had actually galvanised support for Sir Keir, leaving him in a stronger position by the end of the day. A clear-out of senior officials is set to continue, with the Cabinet Secretary, Chris Wormald, also expected to leave his job in the coming days. But there is no doubt the Prime Minister has been wounded by recent events, in particular questions over his judgment in appointing Lord Mandelson as US Ambassador. Any sighs of relief may well be short-lived. The Prime Minister still faces potentially difficult moments ahead, including the Denton and Gorton by-election later this month and the Scottish, Welsh and English local elections in May.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who's widely tipped as a potential successor to Sir Keir Starmer, has revealed that last year he told Lord Mandelson he feared Labour was in big trouble electorally. Mr Streeting has published all their text exchanges from the past 18 months as part of an attempt to distance himself from the peer. Our political correspondent, Joe Pike, reports.
Mr Streeting said he was releasing the messages to dispel the idea that he had something to hide. Some of the exchanges are signed with a kiss. However, Mr Streeting has told the Guardian newspaper that he was not a close friend of Peter Mandelson. In one exchange from last March, the pair agree that the government is facing serious problems and is unable to articulate what it stands for. Mr Streeting says he is concerned that he could lose his own parliamentary seat, writing, "I fear we're in big trouble here and I am toast at the next election." In a separate set of messages from last July, the Health Secretary seeks advice from Lord Mandelson after the French President Emmanuel Macron announced he would be formally recognising a Palestinian state. Mr. Streeting says that morally and politically he believes the UK should do the same, because, he alleges, Israel is committing war crimes before our eyes. These exchanges are likely to have been published anyway, since MPs have forced the government to release all contacts related to the disgraced former ambassador. But by publishing them now, Mr. Streeting is trying to swiftly scotch any suspicions that his Mandelson links could ruin any future leadership bid.
Buckingham Palace says it stands ready to support the police if it's approached about Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's conduct. Officers are assessing suggestions that the King's brother shared confidential reports from his role as the UK's trade envoy with the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Here's our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph.
These are charged times for the royal family. Thames Valley Police is now assessing allegations that in his past role as a UK trade envoy, Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor shared confidential information with Jeffrey Epstein. The former prince has been contacted for comment. A statement released from the King's official spokesman last night described the monarch's profound concern at the continuing allegations around his younger brother's conduct. The statement also said that if approached by the Thames Valley Force, Buckingham Palace would support police inquiries. And against this backdrop, the Prince of Wales continues the second day of his official visit to Saudi Arabia, where he'll attend an e-sports tournament and learn more about the role of women in Saudi society at a training session with a female football team.
A ransom deadline has passed for the release of Nancy Guthrie, the mother of the American TV news presenter Savannah Guthrie. The 84-year-old went missing from her home in Tucson in Arizona 9 days ago. A ransom letter was sent to several media organisations last week, containing a reported demand for $6 million in Bitcoin. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports from Tucson.
Shortly before the deadline, Savannah Guthrie issued a new video statement appealing for the public's help in finding her mother. She said the family was desperate and called the situation a nightmare. Such is her fame that the true crime story of a TV personality and her missing mother has generated thousands of calls to telephone tip lines. But despite a massive search of the area, the FBI has failed to identify a suspect. Contact with the kidnappers has been limited, and it's unclear if the people demanding the money are actually holding Nancy Guthrie, or even that she is still alive. Savannah Guthrie and her family said at the weekend that they intended to pay the ransom, but the deadline passed with no word of Nancy Guthrie's fate and no sign of an end to her family's agonising ordeal.
Police in Australia have defended their actions after officers were involved in violent clashes with protesters opposed to a visit by Israel's president. Isaac Herzog was invited to Australia after a gun attack killed 15 people at a Jewish celebration at Bondi Beach in December. Our Australia correspondent Katie Watson reports from Sydney.
The rally last night started peacefully, but it was when the speeches wrapped up and demonstrators were encouraged to march that it became tense. Police formed lines to prevent demonstrators from breaking through, and in an effort to disperse the crowds as tension rose, pepper spray was used. Video has emerged showing police charging and punching protesters. Police, though, say they did what they needed to do, arguing that officers showed remarkable restraint. Organisers say the violence was the worst they'd seen in years.
The former Glamorgan and England cricketer Steve James and his wife Jane have warned that the condition that killed their daughter in 2020 is still not being properly recognised and treated. A BBC investigation has found sepsis awareness training is still not mandatory at most hospitals in Wales, as Wera Davis reports.
21-year-old Bethan James died 6 years ago after the Welsh Ambulance Service and the University Hospital of Wales in Cardiff failed to recognise and treat clear signs of sepsis. Bethan's parents, Steve and Jane James, have told the BBC they fear the same mistakes would happen today because of the patchy implementation of sepsis awareness training for all clinical staff. Time is critical in treating sepsis, and after the coroner in Bethan's case concluded she would have lived if her treatment had not been delayed, the Welsh Ambulance Service renewed its apology for errors identified in her treatment. The University Hospital of Wales said sepsis awareness and recognition are priorities, and it was continuously reviewing sepsis training.
The South Bank Centre in London has been awarded Grade 2 listed status after a 35-year campaign by supporters. Built in the Brutalist style in the 1960s, the arts complex was designed by a young team led by the architect Norman Engelbach. Cassie Alpin reports.
Once voted Britain's ugliest building because of its extensive use of concrete and angular design, campaigners say they are thrilled that what they describe as visionary architecture is finally on the protection list. The South Bank Centre makes use of external walkways to connect swathes of grey concrete, leading visitors to shows or galleries. Inside, the bold design continues with exposed materials such as timber and glass, providing ample room for exhibitions. The listed designation brings to an end decades of planned attempts to demolish or alter the design of the complex, including one 30 years ago which would have seen a glass roof partially enclose the outdoor spaces. There will now be extra controls on any changes made to the interiors or exteriors of the centre.
Cassie Galpin reporting.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. It is now 9 minutes past seven. Some breaking news this hour. Keir Starmer is still our Prime Minister. There were moments yesterday when that appeared to be in real doubt. Had Angela Rayner not rallied to her former boss's side, had one of the cabinet ministers who tweeted out their support chosen instead to stay silent or to resign, had the Labour leader given a speech to his MPs that had fallen flat instead of appearing, in the words of one critic, to make Starmer appear liberated, it might have all looked very different this morning. Particularly after the Scottish Labour leader went public and said what many Labour MPs have been saying privately for day after day, for week after week, for month after month, Starmer is failing and has got to go. But after all that drama, where does he, more importantly, where do we all now stand? I'm joined in the studio by the Scotland editor, BBC Scotland editor James Cook, but let's hear first from our political editor, Chris Mason, who joins us on the line. Chris, it's over for now, but have we any idea what Keir Starmer plans to do to shore up his position long term?
Yeah, morning to you, Nick. So, yeah, there's no doubt from Keir Starmer's perspective it was a gruelling brush with political mortality yesterday. And for a while, it wasn't clear if the Prime Minister would last the day without saying he was going. And, you know, let's be clear, those moments are rare. Not as rare in recent years as they used to be, but rare nonetheless. And also one of those days where nothing was absurd anymore, or it was absurd, but it seemed entirely possible. So rumours could become fully clothed in an instant. And into that was all sorts of excitable briefing in all sorts of different directions. Now, missives of loyalty from a cabinet are a gold-plated case study in weakness, but they're a whole lot better than the alternative from a Prime Minister's point of view. And they came thick and fast, not just from the Cabinet, but from a breadth of opinion across the party. And I think the intervention from Anas Sarwar, as crucial a moment as it was, actually did prompt the scale and breadth of reaction that we saw after it. Because very briefly around that moment, things could have gone in either direction. For the Prime Minister today, to answer your question, we can expect to see him out and about. I think he'll be out in a community centre. He'll be talking about the cost of living. He'll be talking about the very thing he's been desperate to talk about and heard about publicly since the turn of the year and has barely had the space for various reasons to be able to do so. And we're in the zone, if you like, of another attempted relaunch of his premiership, shorn as he is of his Chief of Staff, Director of Communications, and soon Cabinet Secretary, the most senior civil servant, to, well, have another crack at trying to get it right, as far as his MPs would see it.
Is the key to this, is the key to why it fell apart, what we're told the Prime Minister said to the Scottish Labour leader when he called to warn him that he was about to say quit? He's said to have said, "What's your plan? Who is the next Prime Minister? When does it happen? How does it happen? What do they stand for?" And answers, well, we'll hear from James in a second. I'm not sure many answers came. Chris?
I think that's exactly it. And I think that was the crucial point for so many Labour MPs and Cabinet Ministers. So they walked to the cliff edge. And the nature of the last week means that not only has there been these revelations that have repulsed so many about Lord Mandelson, there's been this acceleration after this slow notching up remorselessly of criticism internally of Sir Keir Starmer. And then because of the acceleration around Lord Mandelson, suddenly the party was staring much sooner than it anticipated at the prospect, at least, of turfing out a Prime Minister and suddenly thought, despite all of their many, many criticisms of Sir Keir Starmer, do we actually really want to do this? And what happens if we do? He stands down. There's no consensus on what comes next. There's a race to be Prime Minister happening within the Labour Party in which the electorate is excluded. The very label they'd thrown around the Conservatives for years about public chaos would suddenly be attached to them. Whoever won wouldn't have that mandate with the public. And they blinked. They concluded in the end, you know, that is too big a leap, at least for now.
Chris, thank you. Let's turn then to James Cook, our Scotland editor. Lots of talk of precipices. Was the reason Anas Sarwar did what he did, which is he's not looking over the precipice as Scottish Labour leader, he's hurtling towards the ground at high speed, isn't he?
Yeah. Good morning, Nick. I mean, that's right. Why did Anas Sarwar take this extraordinary, risky and pretty brutal gamble? Because he thought he was going to lose the Holyrood elections, and not just lose, but potentially, polls suggest, come in third place behind the Scottish National Party and Reform UK. Now, even so, as you've been discussing, it's an incredible step to take. It is not clear, to be honest, what the answers to those questions that were apparently posed by the Prime Minister, what those answers are. And you can only imagine, when Anas Sarwar did this yesterday, colleagues and myself, we thought, well, there must be a plan and there must be people going to follow him. And he now, this morning, looks like a pretty isolated figure within the Labour Party, within the Labour movement. Not only that, but he is going to have to work very closely with people who support the Prime Minister. How's that going to work? The Secretary of State for Scotland, Douglas Alexander, is co-chair of Mr. Sarwar's campaign for the Holyrood elections. Mr. Alexander is supporting the Prime Minister. And from now until May the 7th, everyone in Scottish Labour is going to be asked repeatedly, whose side are you on?
Is it too clever, though, to say, look, Anas Sarwar, the biggest thing he had to do is say that I am not chained to this unpopular leader of the Labour Party down south. I need to demonstrate I'm a Scot. I'm separate. I am my own man. Well, he's done it, hasn't he?
Yes, and for years, the jibe against Labour from their opponents, particularly from the SNP, has been that they are the branch office of a London-based party. And they strongly reject that. They say that's extremely unfair. And indeed, you know, Mr. Sarwar has been making an impact on certain topics in Scotland, particularly in a hospital scandal in Glasgow, in his criticism of the Scottish National Party over their handling of the health service. The SNP say, we're improving the health service, they say, and they say he's acted out of self-preservation here, out of desperation. But he has this position, as you say, where he is trying to stake out himself as his own man. It's just difficult to see it practically in a campaign how that works. But I thought it was striking, Nick, that he said repeatedly yesterday, over and over again, this is about Scotland, about my country. And he is definitely trying to put clear, well, I was going to say blue water, I'm not sure if the Tweed runs blue, but clear water between London and Edinburgh, or Glasgow, if you will.
It is impossible to overstate, isn't it, James, the rage that Labour folk feel that they were finally going to end SNP rule in Scotland. And they feel, is this fair to say, that Keir Starmer has robbed them of that?
Yeah, I think that is fair to say. So that's at the heart of this. That was what lies behind this. Let's be fair to Mr. Sarwar, is that they think the Prime Minister is failing and has failed in his job, and they think that is having a direct impact not just on their electoral prospects for Holyrood, but potentially in Wales, potentially in English local elections, potentially at the next general election. And this conversation about how Anas Sarwar conducts himself and how he is able to run a harmonious, I mean it won't be harmonious, but a coordinated at least campaign is predicated on the notion that Sir Keir Starmer is still in office by May the 7th. I mean, as things stand, I think we probably agree that's likely, but it's not a given, is it?
I don't think anything is a given. James Cook, Chris Mason, other than, as the old saying goes, it's good for trade. James Cook and Chris Mason, thank you very much indeed.
It's just coming around to 18 minutes past seven. Profits fell at BP last year. Well, they did still come in at almost £5.5 billion. Sean Farrington's back with more on that. Hello again.
Yes, hello, Anna. So we've been talking a lot about the oil giant BP and what it's been going through in the last year or so, changing strategy, changing leadership on the way as well. While that's been going on, it has seen those profits come down from the £6.5 billion it made the year before, primarily as the oil price has been lower in that time. Charles Hall is head of research at investment bank Peel Hunt. Morning to you, Charles.
Morning, Sean.
As we have a look at these results this morning, it's notable BP has said it's going to suspend its share buyback. So this is a bit of a similar way of rewarding shareholders to dividends. What does that signify at the business?
Well, I think this is the key announcement of the day from BP, and it really says that they want to repair their balance sheet. They have been increasing debt in order to pay for these buybacks, and now they're recognising that having a more conservative balance sheet will be helpful. You may also have seen that they're saying that they're going to increase their dividends, so they're prioritising dividends over share buybacks, and they've said that they're going to increase dividends by 4% per annum. But as you said, the new CEO, Meg O'Neill, she arrives in April, and the latest statement said that BP aims to be a simpler, leaner and more profitable business. And what's not to like with all of that?
So, Charles, many people will have shares of BP in their pensions or their ISAs one way or another. Can you explain a little bit what this difference means if the share buybacks aren't happening, but they're increasing dividends?
Yeah, so for an ordinary shareholder, most people will prefer dividends over share buyback because the share buyback is effectively helping the valuation of BP, but that's paper money. Dividends is real money coming into your pension or your ISA.
Right, interesting. And elsewhere, Charles, I see Barclays this morning, profits up at the big bank, and it says it's looking to reward sort of shareholders more in a bit of a different way as well.
Yeah, so they're going to be upping their share buyback and their capital returns. And they're talking about a £15 billion capital return 2026 to 2028. So some pretty big numbers there. And, you know, we've got the big beasts of the FTSE 100 reporting today, £350 billion of market value, because AstraZeneca's already reported. And I think this is a really important week to see what's going on in the real economy. Now, last week we had AI Worry Week. This week, it's back to reality with healthcare, energy and financial services to the fore. And I think you can see that coming through with the Barclays results, they've produced profits up 13%. They're delivering a higher return on equity, and they're going to be returning a lot of capital to shareholders.
Interesting. Charles, thank you. We'll keep more of an eye this week as we get more data from some of those biggest companies on our stock markets. Charles Hall there from Peel Hunt.
Thank you, Sean. It's 21 minutes past seven. The Tudor Heart Pendant, the only piece of jewellery of its kind from the time of Henry VIII's marriage to his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, has been bought by the British Museum for £3.5 million. And some of that money came from members of the public, more than 45,000 of them who donated to keep it in the public collection. Well, Nicholas Cullinan joins us, director of the British Museum. Good morning.
Morning.
This is a beautiful little thing. Tell us more about it.
It is an extraordinary object. It was found in 2019 by a detectorist in a field outside Birmingham. And since then, it's been through painstaking research. But it's a 24-carat pendant from around 1520, probably commemorating the marriage of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. So the fact it survives all is extraordinary, but it's absolutely beautiful.
You sort of touched on this, but what is the value to us as a nation, as a country, of having this?
I think this is such an important part of our history, and it's, you know, very little survives around the marriage of Catherine of Aragon to Henry VIII. I think the fact that 45,000 members of the public have got behind this and, you know, donated money to keep it in the country, to keep it on public display, and it will also go on a national tour, shows just, you know, the enthusiasm for this object. It really is unique.
I think people might wonder as well, when something has been found in this country and it's part of our history, why it has to be bought in the way that it is for the public collection?
That's a good question. So there's a very rigorous process when it comes to treasure. And I have to say, we really should thank responsible detectorists who find these things, report them, and then go through a proper process where there's a valuation, which is determined by the Secretary of State. There's an independent panel that come up with a valuation. And then, you know, a museum, if it belongs in a public collection, have the opportunity to buy it. So we don't set the value. The value is set independently and very fairly. But we really should thank detectorists that do this, because basically it gives museums a chance to acquire these extraordinary objects that otherwise would go into private collections or abroad.
And when is this particular one going on display?
It's on display now, so you can come and see it, and then it will go on national tour.
Something that you're also getting later this year is the Bayeux Tapestry. A lot of excitement around that. Also some concern as well about the transport of it. There are some French art experts who've expressed concern, and David Hockney as well is worried about it. He says some things are too precious to take a risk with. Moving the Bayeux Tapestry is one of them. What are you worried about it?
We understand those concerns, but I think it's worth saying that, you know, at the museum, we send and receive thousands of loans every year, many of which are more ancient and indeed more fragile than the Bayeux Tapestry. It's getting the most extraordinary care, both from our colleagues in France, you know, the museum in Bayeux and other colleagues. And we feel very confident about this. We wouldn't be doing this both on the French and the British side if we felt there was a risk.
Right. It's one of those things where if there is any kind of damage to it, and as you say, I'm sure people are delighted, very excited to see it, but something that is so precious, and again, such an important historical artefact, if anything does happen on that journey, people like you will really take the rap for it.
Yeah, I think of that as people's, you know, deep interest in this extraordinary object. But the reality is, you know, much more fragile things travel around the world all the time. So we know what we're doing.
And what about the timeline for that one? When will that be on display?
So that goes on display in September this year, and it will be on display until June of next year. So we're just getting ready. It's very exciting. It's going to be really a blockbuster exhibition.
Nicholas Cullinan, the director of the British Museum. Thank you for joining us.
It is 24 minutes past seven, time for the sport. Here's Carfi.
Morning. Thank you very much. It was a difficult day for Team GB at the Winter Olympics yesterday. Kirsty Muir finished in fourth place in the freestyle skiing women's slopestyle final. Mia Brooks just missed out on a podium finish in the snowboard big air final. Bruce Moat and Jen Dodds topped the table after the round-robin stage of the mixed curling, but they lost their semi-final 9-3 to Sweden. Let's speak to the chief sports correspondent for The Times, Matt Lawton, who's at the Winter Olympics in Italy. Morning, Matt.
Morning, Cathy.
Hi. Fourth place. Such a disappointing place to be in the context of an Olympics, in any context, really. Muir and Brooks, though, are young athletes. Am I being overly optimistic by saying it bodes well for 4 years' time?
Well, maybe, although the thing about their sports is people tend to be brilliant at a young age. The fact of the matter is Mia Brooks won the world title at 16. So to say this is kind of a, you know, almost like a training run for her out here is not really true. She came here very much regarded as the best in the sport. And in fairness to her last night, and I was stood just a few feet from Eve Muirhead and senior members of the British team, you know, she tried something that had never been done before in the Olympics. This move caught her, and I must admit, it's a bit of a voyage of discovery for me.
Backside 16-20, is that what you're going for?
Backside 16-20, yeah. Which was these sort of four and a half rotations, and she very nearly nailed it. And if she'd done it, it would have been a remarkable moment. And talking to her afterwards, you know, she said there was no point in sort of playing it safe and maybe coming third or fourth. She went for gold because she is that good. Everyone knows she's that good. She still has a chance. The fact of the matter is both Muir and Brooks have another opportunity. And a lot of people think in Mia Brooks's case that the slope style is her best event anyway. She won the world junior title at 15 in that discipline. So that's still to come. Muir still has the big air. But yeah, it felt a bit cruel yesterday. The curling was different. That was, you know, that was a capitulation. Sixth end, they somehow lost five stones in one end to the Swedes. It went from 3-3 to 8-3, and they were doomed after that. And that's a real shame because they beat the Italians in the qualification. They're the defending champions. They do play them again today. So it could be that the medal hunt ends later today if Moa and Dodds can beat the Italians, who they've already beaten once out here.
Yeah, Martin Dodds in that bronze medal match later today. They have to gamble, don't they? But why is it that a gold medal on snow is such a challenge for British athletes?
Well, it's probably stating the obvious, but it's probably because we don't have any mountains. You know, Mia Brooks trains quite close to where I live. You know, I said in a piece this week that she trains on an indoor ski slope that's sort of crammed between the Trafford Centre shopping centre and a dinosaur themed crazy golf course. This is not a kid that's grown up in the Swiss Alps. You know, she's got these snowboard mad parents, and they're out here, bless them, staying in their camper van because the hotel prices in Lavinia are pretty steep. But yeah, that's it. You know, the British team's been trying since 1924 to win a gold medal on snow, and it hasn't happened yet.
Matt Lawson, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We'll keep you up to date on what is happening. Lila Fear and Lewis Gibson began their campaign to win Britain's first figure skating medal since Torvald and Dean. They are currently in fourth place. That event concludes tomorrow. And there has been an intense backdrop of political tension and uncertainty at the start of the Men's T20 World Cup in India and Sri Lanka, with Bangladesh boycotting the tournament and Pakistan involved in a 10-day standoff, claiming they would not play their scheduled match against India. That decision was reversed last night when the Pakistan government ended its order on the team's boycott, saying the decision had been made with the aim of protecting the spirit of cricket.
Carthy, thank you very much indeed. This afternoon, Radio 4 heads back to school to explore why one subject is facing a dramatic decline.
I'm Christopher Eccleston, an actor, writer and performer, and I'm investigating the sharp fall in drama education in English schools.
There's been a 48% decline in drama A-level entries since 2010. That's ridiculous. It's halved. The GCSE, it's halved.
I'm finding out how this has happened and why it matters.
It's more than just like something you do in school. It's sort of helped me shape who I am today.
Drama in Schools, an unfolding tragedy, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. This afternoon at 4.
Look forward to that. Can we look forward to the weather? It'll be cloudy with a chance of the odd bright break. It says here a few spots of drizzle are possible in the morning, but patchy rain will develop later in the day.
Something else to look forward to as well. They're always wonderful. Sir Michael Palin will join us in the next half hour to tell us about his return to drama in the new BBC series Small Profits, the script of which was a decade in the making.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson at almost 7:30. Here's Caroline Nichols with a summary of the news.
Senior Labour MPs have rallied around Sir Keir Starmer after his most bruising day yet as Prime Minister. Yesterday he faced calls from the Scottish Labour leader to resign, but addressing members of the parliamentary party in Westminster last night, Sir Keir said he wouldn't walk away from his mandate. This morning the Prime Minister will host a cabinet meeting in Number 10. He's also facing having to further rebuild his team of senior officials, with the Cabinet Secretary Chris Wormald expected to leave in the coming days. The Health Secretary Wes Streeting has published text messages he sent to Lord Mandelson, who was sacked as ambassador to the US. Mr. Streeting, who is widely tipped as a future successor to Sir Keir Starmer, insisted they were not close friends. Buckingham Palace says it stands ready to support the police if it's approached about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's conduct. Officers are assessing suggestions that the King's brother shared confidential reports from his role as the UK's trade envoy with the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has been approached for comment. A deadline has passed for a ransom demand in return for the release of the mother of the American news anchor Savannah Guthrie. Despite a huge search of the area in Arizona where 84-year-old Nancy Guthrie went missing 9 days ago, police haven't identified a suspect. Shortly before the deadline, Savannah Guthrie said her family had reached an hour of desperation. The former Glamorgan and England cricketer Steve James and his wife Jane say they fear there'll be more deaths from sepsis, the condition which killed their daughter, because of the patchy implementation of training in hospitals. The Welsh Government said it was taking steps to improve how the NHS recognises and responds to sepsis. The South Bank Centre in London has been awarded Grade 2 listed status after a 35-year campaign by supporters. Built in the Brutalist style in the 1960s, the arts complex uses grey concrete and other exposed building materials to provide spaces for performances and exhibitions.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 28 minutes to 8. Buckingham Palace stands ready to help the police as they investigate potential wrongdoing by Andrew Mountbatten Windsor through his links with Jeffrey Epstein, something which he continues to strenuously deny. This has come from the King, who released an extraordinary statement yesterday, his first on the matter since the latest tranche of Epstein files was released. Charles also said that his and the Queen's thoughts and sympathies were with the victims of abuse. Now, 11 of those women are represented by Lisa Bloom, a high-profile US attorney, and I asked her what the palace could do to help. But before that, we discussed the decision by Ghislaine Maxwell yesterday, Epstein's accomplice and former girlfriend, not to give new information to US lawmakers about what she knows.
Well, it's terribly disappointing, but Ghislaine Maxwell has always had one and only one priority, and that is Ghislaine Maxwell. We know that she doesn't care about the victims. She was criminally convicted beyond a reasonable doubt after a full trial of being a sex trafficker and also of abusing these girls herself. So she has not changed. She's not going to do anything to help anyone except herself.
What is the mood and the feeling among the women that you represent? Because so many files have now been released. There is some new information, but there are still huge gaps in what we know about what happened. Do they feel like things are moving forward?
Not really. The mood is disappointment and, frankly, disgust in the way that this has all gone down. Look, only about half of the files have been released, about 3 million pages out of 6 million, as we understand it. And one of my clients, her name was revealed in the release that just happened a week ago, over 500 times. Meanwhile, the names of a lot of men who are emailing Jeffrey Epstein about 9-year-old girls, 10-year-old girls, their names are redacted. Why? No explanation has been given. So it seems like this release has been primarily to protect the perpetrators, while the victims, and my client's not the only one, have had some of their identifying information and even their names revealed.
I wanted to know what you think about what we saw here in the UK yesterday, this unprecedented statement from Buckingham Palace, the King saying that he is profoundly concerned at the allegations about his younger brother, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, and also saying that the palace stands ready to support the police. What is your interpretation of what he had to say?
I'm very appreciative, and my clients are very appreciative that he is actually talking about the victims, centering the victims, standing with them. Of course, it's very difficult to stand against your own brother, whether you're a king or an ordinary person. And we really appreciate that he is encouraging Andrew to come forward, come to Congress, talk, reveal what he knows, just as we have been demanding for years and years.
Would that be the key thing for you that would help now, for Andrew to actually come and speak to those lawmakers and tell them what he knows?
Yes, it's essential. Anybody with any shred of decency would do that.
And when the palace talks about standing ready to support the police, what other useful things could be done to help with this investigation?
Well, of course, what the police want is information and evidence. That's their job, to gather all of that. They can only do that through witnesses, people who have knowledge. So that would be for Andrew or for anybody else who has information, evidence, details, photographs, text messages, whatever it may be, to come forward and give that to the police so we can ultimately get to the bottom of accountability for anybody else who was involved.
So it really is wide ranging. Anything, any small detail could help.
Absolutely, yes.
You talk about some of those, you know, things like text messages, witness statements. And one thing that seems to have been uncovered in the files this time is the links between friends of Jeffrey Epstein and Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, and the idea that people were met and entertained, were taken to the palace. So presumably if that happened, then there will be other people who will have seen that happen and known that it happened.
Well, that's right. I mean, Jeffrey Epstein could not have been such a prolific predator without many, many people around him, mostly high-profile men, enabling him, supporting him. I mean, as we see in the files, it's so disgusting, joking with him about what he's doing to these girls. I mean, this was all just a great time for them while these girls were suffering and are continuing to this day, probably for the rest of their lives, unfortunately, to be suffering from what he did to them, from the sexual assaults that he gave to them. So, yes, of course, any decent person would want everybody to be brought to justice who's been involved in this.
Yeah. When we say any decent person, I'm curious as well, you know, presumably household staff, people who were not involved, but who may have witnessed something, you would be speaking directly to them as well and saying, please come forward.
Yes. I mean, the problem for everyday people is they're always terrified to speak out against people in power. I get that. I've spent my career going after people in power, and I understand the blowback that you get, the online hate, the threats, etc. So Those folks have to be protected. If someone is a witness and they have important information, they need to be protected when they come forward. Otherwise, there's no trust in the system and they're not going to come forward.
As things stand at the moment, the police here in the UK are actively investigating information that may have been shared by Andrew Mountbatten Windsor with Jeffrey Epstein to do with trade, commercially sensitive information that he may have shared that he shouldn't have shared. The police investigation into the sexual exploitation of the victims is at the moment on pause. They have said that without new information, that's how it will stay. But presumably you are hoping that that investigation could be reopened if something new, something substantial does come to light.
Absolutely. We are always hoping. I represent 11 women who were sexually assaulted by Jeffrey Epstein, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, out there. And, you know, sometimes people get older, they get a little stronger, they get into a more stable place in their life, they get an attack of courage, and they decide to come forward and say what they know. And if that happens, the police can reopen the investigation.
Lisa Bloom, thank you for joining us.
It is now 21 minutes to 8 o'clock. If you love Michael Palin, if you love the wry, gentle humour of Mackenzie Crook's The Detectorists on BBC Two, you're in for a treat because Palin and Crook have combined their considerable talents in a new BBC series called Small Profits, in which Sir Michael cooks up an ancient recipe in his shed, or rather his character does, involving rainwater, horse manure and a little alchemy to produce spirits who can predict the future.
Eventually, this brilliant man managed to grow and generate homunculi. Tiny prophets who lived in great glass jars full of water.
Wait a minute, Dad. I remember this story. You used to tell it to me before bed. Little people in jars. But, Dad, I don't think it actually happened.
Oh, it did happen. I was there. I saw them. There were six of them.
Yeah, I remember there was a king and a queen, a monk,
a knight, a peasant and a seraph. Exquisite little beings.
They could predict the future.
Yeah, they could answer any question once they'd reached the state of divination, and they had to answer truthfully.
Sir Michael Palin joins us on the line to tell us what this is all about. Morning to you, Michael. Who are the little people?
Good morning. Well, they are called homunculi. Which I don't think anybody knows anything about, apart from Mackenzie, who found in a book somewhere that there was proof that many, many years ago, a man had found a recipe to create little people in jars, an alchemist, a magical alchemist. And I play this rather confused, but creatively confused guy in a care home. And I have kept this information, and I give it to my son, played by Piers Quigley, quite brilliantly, in order to help him find his partner, who he lost many years ago, and he doesn't know quite where she's gone. So this, what seems a very odd, strange thing, becomes magical and quite helpful and quite improving, and helps him in his quest for his lost partner.
Was it the magic of that story that attracted you to return to acting? Because it's been a few years, hasn't it?
Yes, it has, really. I mean, the last thing I did, I think, was actually The Green Man in Wurzel Gummidge with Mackenzie Crook, after which I had open heart surgery. Nothing to do with my performance. Yeah. Just
all the script,
coincidental. Yeah.
And you love his writing, don't you? I think many of us who love his work think Mackenzie has this incredible capacity to find emotional depth, to find intelligence in people who on the surface are made to appear very ordinary.
Yes, I think that's his great skill, one of his many great skills. I think he's a marvellous writer, one of the most original, because he deals with people in a very empathetic human way. This is not a story where you'll have car chases and people wanting to kill each other. It's really about there's a warmth in the way he writes about people. And every single character in this series gets their moment, however small it might be. You might be two lines or one line, and that line is thought out and is careful and is given to the actor as something special. And so I think what Mackenzie does is creates things very personal kind of writing which, if you like it, it's just the best of all to do, because you know it's so sympathetic to people.
It's striking when you say there aren't the car chases and so on. There's this suggestion that modern media needs to grab the attention, to get it quickly, to do it with drama. And yet even listening to your words in that clip we just heard and the music, there's a gentleness to it, isn't there?
Yes, yeah, there is, but it's quite incisive. It's not sort of dreamy. He can write very funny lines, and very tart and quite sort of sardonic in their way. But he just examines. I mean, this is all about life in the suburbs of South Manchester. It's not in South America or anywhere else. And he can find in that world an amazing amount of humour and magic, and you know. Good people and doing very funny things.
That's Manchester for you, Michael, you see. And now, what about
the Sheffield lad? Yeah. I wouldn't say yes. We've got the wrong city, but still.
Yes, quite. Another great northern city, of course. Now, what about the travel? Because people still, it seems to be expressed quite a lot of surprise you're still doing it, but you are and you still appear to love it.
Yes, I express more surprise than anybody else. But I love travelling and I'm carrying on doing these three-part series, because people still want me to do it. I think it's terrific for your sort of physical and mental health, and I feel terribly lucky that I'm dragged around the world to see places that I've not seen before, understand the world a bit better, and get a perspective on the world. I think at home you tend to just think of London as the centre of the world and all that, but you go off to other places, Venezuela, Nigeria, wherever, and you find out, you learn a lot from those countries because they are very different.
Is it a secret where you're going next, Michael?
Yes, it is, Nick.
We'll have you back.
I'll tell you off air.
Yes, we'll have you back to reveal. Oh, no, don't tell me. You've got to tell the listeners at the same time. We look forward to that. We greatly look forward to seeing you in Small Profits, which was on BBC Two last night, but of course it's on BBC iPlayer now. So Michael Palin there in Small Profits. Thank you.
You know, some of those old travelogues as well are really well worth a rewatch now. Things like Around the World in 80 Days, because some of the places have changed so much in the intervening decades.
But the joy Michael takes in the people he meets is what makes it so wonderful, isn't it?
It is special, isn't it? Now, it is 7:45. It's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning in the studio with us is Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg, Senior Rabbi of Masorti Judaism. Good morning.
Good morning. Speak about hope. I hear those words everywhere in these frightening times. At synagogue, we've just read the Ten Commandments, beginning with, I am your God. Two rabbis, whose teachings I admire, experienced those words very differently, and the struggle for hope lies in the tension between their associations. Hugo Grin, whose warm voice, often heard on radio, I hugely miss, survived Auschwitz. He wrote, Auschwitz-Birkenau was the perversion of all the Ten Commandments. God was replaced by a Führer and his minions, who claimed for themselves the power of life and death. Murder was at the heart of that culture, and killers were promoted and honoured. That's what I Am Your God reminded him of. Nazism is gone, but tyranny, killing and contempt are at large in our world, threatening our freedoms and future. Rabbi Yehuda Arielev of Ger, who died last century, intuited a very different voice in the commandments. He wrote, when God said, I am, the world fell silent. Every living being listened. They heard the words not from heaven, but within themselves. They felt, this is about who I truly am. The life force which flows through everything is speaking to me. In that moment, a deep awareness connected all existence, humans, animals, every breathing being, and cruelty and hatred vanished. I believe that may be what we feel when, humbled by some act of kindness, when touched by closeness to another person, when silenced by listening to the birds, when we sense in the woodlands these trees, some hidden life force connects us. A consciousness infinitely greater than me, me, me flows through us then. It's what Wordsworth called a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. Here lies a quiet but powerful antidote to the horror Hugo Grin was forced to experience when tyrants replaced God dictating who must live or die. Here is an understanding that motivates us to love and give. I think of my Israeli friend, who, despite the violence afflicting both peoples, supported her Palestinian colleague who bravely made soup in Gaza for hungry children. I'm mindful of the Ukrainian grandma, since killed, who refused to leave her frontline home in Kherson, and despite the bombing, sent me a gift of honey for the Jewish New Year. What makes people do that? I believe it's the deeper voice that calls us, beyond all differences and hatreds, to care for each other and the world. In that voice lies our hope.
That was Thought for the Day with Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg, Senior Rabbi of Masorti Judaism. It's 12 minutes to 8.
Sepsis is one of the UK's biggest killers. It kills tens of thousands of people every year. Sepsis occurs when the immune system overreacts to an infection and starts attacking our own tissues and organs. But it can be treated if, and it is a big if, it is spotted early enough. 21-year-old Bethan James died in Cardiff 6 years ago after ambulance and hospital staff failed to recognise, failed to treat clear signs of sepsis. Her father, her mother, say they fear the same thing could happen to someone else today. A BBC investigation has found that awareness training of sepsis is still not mandatory at many hospitals, and nor do many ambulance trusts issue early treatment antibiotics in their vehicles. We'll talk to someone from the Sepsis Trust, indeed the founder of it, in just a second. But first, Wira Davis reports.
So, basically, I'm just going to tell you what I think I'm going to be in 10 years' time. I'm currently...
As a teenager, Bethan James was social media savvy and ambitious. On her own blog, she imagined one day being happy at work and perhaps she'd have children.
I also hope that my friends and family are healthy and that I still have...
Memories and photographs are all that Steve and Jane James have left of those dreams. As a cricketer for Glamorgan and England, often away from home, Steve's time with his daughter was always precious. In February 2020, Bethan had been ill for days, but her dad went to Ireland for work after reassurances from doctors it wasn't serious. It was a decision Steve will always regret. By the time Bethan was admitted to hospital, her early warning or news score was recorded at 8, indicating her vital signs were critical. But Jane remembers being helpless, as neither in the ambulance nor at Cardiff's University Hospital did Bethan get the intensive care her condition urgently required.
They were just quite dismissive of her symptoms. Like, her heart rate was high, her blood pressure was lower at that time, and she should have been in intensive care. She should have been following a sepsis protocol, but that wasn't recognised. The worst thing is that I know she could have survived had she had the right treatment, and that's, I don't want any other family to go through this.
The coroner at Bethan James's inquest concluded that she would have lived if her care and her treatment had not been delayed. But 6 years after her death and other similar high-profile cases, her parents say nothing has changed. Nearly 50,000 people die each year in the UK from sepsis, more than from breast cancer, bowel cancer and prostate cancer combined. Yet there are still glaring inconsistencies in how it's recognised and treated. We discovered that sepsis awareness training isn't mandatory for all clinical staff at most Welsh hospitals, including the one where Bethan died. Early treatment with antibiotics in ambulances can be life-saving, but only crews in Scotland and here on the Isle of Wight do this routinely. John Pike from the Isle of Wight Ambulance Service says here, where transfer times are critical, they've treated thousands of patients with sepsis.
What we've chosen to do on the island is to do something which is a whole system approach, getting the diagnosis as early as possible. And here we've decided that should be first clinical contact. So the ambulance service are the people that meet these patients usually first. So very important to get treatment in early.
Sepsis awareness is still patchy, although after the death of 13-year-old Martha Mills in 2021, the introduction of Martha's Rule in England allows parents to ask for an urgent second opinion. The Welsh Ambulance Service has renewed its apology after errors identified in Bethan's case. The University Hospital of Wales said sepsis awareness and early recognition are priorities, and it was continuously reviewing sepsis training.
It's a totally abnormal life, just so many dark moments, and pulls at your heartstring and think, you know, where would Bethan be today and what would she be doing?
Steve and Jane James want sepsis awareness training and a similar thing to Martha's Rule across the UK, unable to reconcile that if they'd lived in another part of the country, Bethan would still be here.
Wira Davis reporting, listening to that. Dr. Ron Daniels, the founder, Chief Medical Officer of the UK Sepsis Trust. Good morning to you, Dr. Daniels.
Good morning.
The detail of Bethan's case is what's shocking, isn't it? 5 trips to hospital in 10 days before her death. How typical of people who die of sepsis are those early warnings that are missed?
Well, we hear, as a charity, we hear time and time again stories where often a young person has their symptoms dismissed, brushed aside as if they're not important. We even hear about particularly young women being dismissed as being hysterical when they're clearly displaying the hallmark signs of sepsis. The reality is that young people compensate for sepsis. Their vital signs don't change as much as they do in other people. So when a young person comes in with an early warning score of 8, that's a significant issue and really should be taken very, very seriously indeed.
So part of the problem here is a misconception about who gets sepsis. Is there also a misconception that it's not just the old that get it, but it's often caused by wounds? Because that's only the case in a small number of cases, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So sepsis, the most common causes of sepsis are common infections like a urinary infection, pneumonia, problems in the abdomen. As you say, skin and soft tissue infections like an infected wound, that's less than 10% of cases. And the other misconception, again, as you say, is that this is only a condition of old, frail people. Yes, it's true that older people are more likely to develop sepsis than healthy working age adults, but anyone can get sepsis. And in fact, in some really good data coming out of New York State, nearly half of adults admitted to their hospitals each year are working age adults.
So is it as simple as saying that this is about better training, about spreading best practice?
So it is. It really is. It's around getting a partnership between a public who are aware of sepsis, are empowered to access healthcare at the right time and with the right degree of urgency, and health professionals who are well trained. But it's naive to think that it's just about training. This is about organisational culture. It's about healthcare systems, be it an entire country's healthcare system or an individual hospital or GP surgery, that are well equipped to deal with sepsis and nurture a culture where their health professionals are encouraged to think about sepsis and act rapidly.
Bethan's parents clearly believe that if she had lived, for example, on the Isle of Wight instead of in Wales, that she'd still be alive today. Now, as we were hearing in Wira's report just there, there is a different approach. Ambulances carry these very powerful antibiotics. There are reasons, aren't there, that some ambulance trusts are nervous about having those powerful antibiotics on every ambulance in the country?
So there absolutely are reasons. Firstly, the academic literature hasn't decisively proven that antibiotics in an ambulance are helpful. But we are living in a country where there are significant delays getting ambulances to patients. In fact, the official guidance is take yourself straight to A&E or call an ambulance if you're critically ill. And so there's very significant delays with ambulances getting to the home. Even when they get to the hospital, they're often stuck outside A&E with a sick patient inside for some hours before the emergency department admits that patient. So I absolutely support, and indeed NICE, the guidelines committee, they also support that where transit times to hospital are routinely in excess of 1 hour, the ambulance services should consider mechanisms to deliver intravenous antibiotics.
And the other thing we heard about was Martha's Rule. We heard so much of it on this programme in recent months and years. Only operates this right to demand a second medical opinion, only applies in England, as I understand it. Do you think it would make a difference and would have made a difference to Bethan if it was available elsewhere?
So for balance, Wales does have the Call for Concern programme in many of its hospitals, but there are fundamental differences.
Which is similar, isn't it? Oh, sorry, forgive me.
It's similar, but there are differences. So Martha's Rule empowers anybody to call for a second opinion, be it the patient, be it someone who loves them or cares for them, or be it a health professional looking after them. So if the most junior healthcare assistant is worried about a patient, they can pick up that phone. So it's much more empowering, it's more accessible, and I think, you know, Wales really need to consider how Call for Concern, if they continue to call it that, can be expanded so that it is more accessible and more empowering.
Dr.
I think it would have made a difference in Bethan's case. case, absolutely.
Forgive me, that was an important last point to make. Dr. Ron Daniels, Chief Medical Officer, founder of the UK Sepsis Trust. Thank you for joining us.
In 2019, we began investigating the disappearance of Dr. Ruja Ignatova.
I believe we are a very special network.
A scammer who stole billions from investors around the world.
Number one cryptocurrency globally.
She's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And now we have some unmissable updates.
She has money, and when you have money, you have power.
Join me, Jamie Bartlett, as the hunt for the missing crypto queen continues. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Time for the weather. Here's Sarah Keith-Lucas. Morning.
Morning, Anna. We have got a blanket of grey over us today. Once again, extensive low cloud. And that's bringing some hill fog, some drizzle this morning. And there'll be areas of rain coming and going through the day. Across southeast England into the Midlands and for eastern England, we've got that low cloud and drizzle first thing. There'll be a few heavier spells of rain intermittently later on, but equally a few brighter intervals. You might glimpse a bit of blue sky, but it will be very limited. Temperatures around 11 or 12 degrees. For the southwest of England and for Wales, a cloudy morning with some drizzly showers. A bit of heavier rain, though, is moving in across the Isles of Scilly and into Cornwall. That will push its way northeastwards. So still plenty of showers into the afternoon, particularly for Wales, but some brighter spells in the south and southwest, and temperatures around 10 or 11. For northern England and Northern Ireland, as well as southwest Scotland and northern Scotland today, it's going to be damp and grey once again. Patchy rain through this morning should ease a little bit later on, I think, before the rain peps up again into the evening hours. Temperatures here are going to be around 7 to 9. But it's across the east of Scotland that we're going to see the most persistent rain today. A yellow rain warning from the Met Office comes into force at 9 a.m. So another wet day to come, another 40 to 60 millimetres of rain possible, 6 or 7 Celsius, and some snow on top of the highest ground. Overnight remains cloudy, damp and frost-free once again. More rain for some of us in the south tomorrow, and it turns colder from the north.
Thank you, Sarah. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 10th of February. The headlines this morning. Sir Keir Starmer has told Labour MPs he's won every fight he's been in and won't walk away from being Prime Minister. We'll speak to Ed Miliband in the next half hour. Buckingham Palace has said it's ready to support the police as officers consider allegations about the conduct of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And one of London's most recognisable buildings, the South Bank Centre, has been given listed status after decades of lobbying by campaigners.
Also coming up this hour, universities have been told to step up their defences against intimidation and censorship from China. And Cressida Cowell, author of the best-selling How to Train Your Dragon series, shares the book that sparked her love of reading.
It was like a pathway inlaid with treasures that grew in value along the way. Bolts of fine fabric and books, paintings of ancestors and carpenter tools, until one could see cages of ducklings now quiet with thirst.
The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
Sir Keir Starmer appears safe in his job for the time being after surviving the most difficult day of his premiership so far. Yesterday, the Prime Minister defied a call for him to quit from the leader of Scottish Labour, Anas Sawar, and secured the backing of his cabinet, before telling a packed meeting of Labour MPs he was not prepared to abandon his mandate. Here's our political correspondent, Nick Eardley.
The public backing of every member of the cabinet means the immediate threat to Sir Keir Starmer has cooled. He told Labour MPs last night that he wasn't prepared to walk away, adding defiantly, "Every fight I've been in, I have won." Senior cabinet members told the BBC they thought yesterday's call from the Scottish Labour leader, Anas Sawar, for the Prime Minister to quit had actually galvanised support for Sir Keir, leaving him in a stronger position by the end of the day. A clear-out of senior officials is set to continue, with the Cabinet Secretary, Chris Wormald, also expected to leave his job in the coming days. But there is no doubt the Prime Minister has been wounded by recent events, in particular questions over his judgment in appointing Lord Mandelson as US Ambassador. Any sighs of relief may well be short-lived.
The Labour MP for Hull East, Carl Turner, told us he saw a new side to the Prime Minister at last night's meeting.
I think he was a different man yesterday when we saw him. He was strong, he was determined, he was reflective, he was apologetic. But let me tell you this, that was not a man who is on his knees. He was determined to stay where he is for the betterment of the British public, and that's what we expect him to do.
The Prime Minister will attempt to regain control of the political agenda today when he chairs a meeting of his cabinet. Our political editor, Chris Mason, considers the challenges ahead for Sir Keir Starmer.
The Prime Minister has had a political near-death experience and survived, for now at least. At various points, he looked like he might be done for, and imminently, if the Scottish Labour leader Anna Sarwar's desire to dislodge Sir Keir Starmer had had public accomplices, that could have been it. Of course, missives of loyalty from cabinet ministers towards the Prime Minister shouldn't be newsworthy. They only become so when the opposite seems feasible. This has been a deeply wounding week for Sir Keir, and he is weaker for it. And jeopardy peppers the diary ahead for him. The Gorton and Denton by-election in Greater Manchester in just over a fortnight. The Scottish and Welsh devolved elections and English local elections in May. The Health Secretary Wes Streeting's transparent attempts to cleanse his reputation after years of association with Lord Mandelson by publishing their text exchanges is a reminder of his ambition and positioning, and a reminder that the story of the consequences of recent days is far from over.
Buckingham Palace says it stands ready to support the police if it's approached about Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's conduct. Officers are assessing suggestions that the King's brother shared confidential reports from his role as the UK's trade envoy with the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Here's our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph.
These are charged times for the royal family. Thames Valley Police is now assessing allegations that in his past role as a UK trade envoy, Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor shared confidential information with Jeffrey Epstein. The former prince has been contacted for comment. A statement released from the King's official spokesman last night described the monarch's profound concern at the continuing allegations around his younger brother's conduct. The statement also said that if approached by the Thames Valley Force, Buckingham Palace would support police inquiries. And against this backdrop, the Prince of Wales continues the second day of his official visit to Saudi Arabia, where he'll attend an e-sports tournament and learn more about the role of women in Saudi society at a training session with a female football team.
A ransom deadline has passed for the release of Nancy Guthrie, the mother of the American TV news presenter Savannah Guthrie. The 84-year-old went missing from her home in Tucson in Arizona 9 days ago. A ransom letter was sent to several media organisations last week, containing a reported demand for $6 million in Bitcoin. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports from Tucson.
Shortly before the deadline, Savannah Guthrie issued a new video statement appealing for the public's help in finding her mother. She said the family was desperate and called the situation a nightmare. Such is her fame that the true crime story of a TV personality and her missing mother has generated thousands of calls to telephone tip lines. But despite a massive search of the area, the FBI has failed to identify a suspect. Contact with the kidnappers has been limited, and it's unclear if the people demanding the money are actually holding Nancy Guthrie, or even that she is still alive. Savannah Guthrie and her family said at the weekend that they intended to pay the ransom, but the deadline passed with no word of Nancy Guthrie's fate and no sign of an end to her family's agonising ordeal.
Police in Australia have defended their actions after officers were involved in violent clashes with protesters opposed to a visit by Israel's president. Isaac Herzog was invited to Australia after a gun attack killed 15 people at a Jewish celebration at Bondi Beach in December. Our Australia correspondent Katie Watson reports from Sydney.
The rally last night started peacefully, but it was when the speeches wrapped up and demonstrators were encouraged to march that it became tense. In the wake of the Bondi shooting, New South Wales introduced restrictions on public protest. And just a few days ago, further powers were given to police to shut down areas of the city because of the visit by Israel's president. That meant that while people were allowed to gather, they weren't allowed to march. Police formed lines to prevent demonstrators from breaking through. And in an effort to disperse the crowds as tension rose, pepper spray was used. Video has emerged showing police charging and punching protesters. Police, though, say they did what they needed to do, arguing that officers showed remarkable restraint. Organisers say the violence was the worst they'd seen in years.
The Environment Agency says flooding is expected in 99 areas as downpours continue. The warnings apply mainly to parts of the south of England, around the southern Welsh border and the East Midlands. Forecasters say there's no sign of a prolonged dry spell for at least a week. The government has announced it will spend £5 billion to pay off up to 90% of the debts that councils have built up through spending on special educational needs. Local authorities will start to receive the money from the autumn this year. Here's our education reporter, Kate McGough.
The Local Government Association warned last week that 8 in 10 councils wouldn't be able to balance their books if they had to honour debts built up in recent years due to the cost of supporting children and young people with special educational needs and disabilities. Now the government has said that from this autumn, councils will receive a grant paying off 90% of any high needs debts that they've built up to the end of this financial year. Further details are expected in the school's white paper, which is due out in the coming weeks. Ministers have said this will include how to deal with any debts built up by councils from this April to when central government is due to take over managing special needs budgets in 2028. The Local Government Association has welcomed the plans, which they said removed the immediate threat of insolvency for many councils.
The government is lowering the minimum age for train drivers from 20 to 18 to try to encourage more young people into the industry. The Department for Transport says a quarter of train drivers are expected to reach retirement age by 2030. Legislation to reduce the age limit is being brought before Parliament to coincide with National Apprenticeship Week. The change will bring the UK into line with other countries, including Germany and Australia. A building that was once voted Britain's ugliest, the South Bank Centre in London, has been granted listed status. It marks the end of a 35-year campaign to protect the brutalist sections of the complex, which were added to the existing Royal Festival Hall in the 1960s. The director of the 20th Century Society, Catherine Croft, told us why the building is so special.
It's easy to dismiss concrete as being crude and ugly, but actually there are lots of different ways that concrete's used at the South Bank Centre, both ones that are cast in situ on the site and panels that were made off-site and brought together. The whole thing was incredibly well thought out and constructed.
Catherine Croft.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 8:10. For years, the royal family has tried to stay tight-lipped in the face of scandal. Never complain, never explain became synonymous with their centuries-old approach, firmly turning their backs on engaging through the media and remaining quiet until events of such seismic importance forced some type of response. The relationship between convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein and the former Prince Andrew, now stripped of his royal title by King Charles, has become one of those events. The King has now intervened again, his first public comment since the latest tranche of Epstein files was released that have raised fresh questions about Andrew's conduct. Charles says Buckingham Palace stands ready to help the police as they investigate potential wrongdoing. He also expressed profound concern at the allegations which continue to come to light and noted that his and the Queen's thoughts and sympathies were with the victims of abuse. Well, statements like this from the royals are still rare, and what people want to know now is what is the substance behind those words? How far is the King prepared to go to help the police investigation into his brother, who continues to strenuously deny any wrongdoing? Well, Daniel Arelf is our senior royal correspondent in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia at the moment on a royal visit with Prince William. Daniela, these were words which many will feel were necessary, but how much impact is there from them, and how much substance will there be?
Well, Anna, the royal media teams are always carefully calibrating just how involved they should get publicly in any situation. And we had this really unusual moment yesterday of having two official statements from two royal households, Kensington Palace and Buckingham Palace, within a few hours of each other, laying out the thinking of both the King and the Princess of Wales. Neither mentioned the words Jeffrey Epstein, but both statements were made because of the noise around around this story and because of the fresh allegations. I mean, my gut in these situations and in the heat of a story like this is not saying anything at all, just doesn't hold anymore. In a world where accountability, transparency are so important, in this sea of negative headlines around Epstein, I think there was a need to hear something, especially from the king as head of the royal family. And Buckingham Palace will be hoping that the statement last night shows leadership from the king and will give a sense that the royal family understands the pain of victims and the scale and the importance of the Epstein story. So I think they will hope that this public messaging will perhaps make people understand better their position.
Daniela Ralph, our senior royal correspondent, thank you. Well, I've been speaking to Ailsa Anderson, who was press secretary to the late Queen Elizabeth II, and she told me what she thought of the King's statement yesterday.
I think it was really interesting, the wording he did use. I mean, profound concerns. Profound is a word I think that's actually come from the King himself. It's not just his spokesperson sort of drafting it. So I think it's incredibly personal and actually quite unprecedented. And it just really goes to show that we're at that point at the moment with this story, a story that started, that broke in 2010. So, you know, this is a story that's been going on for many years now. It just shows the seriousness of what it is, and the, you know, and the anxiety that's going on in the royal household and Buckingham Palace to actually sort of conclude they needed to make a statement like that. And of course, it's on the same day that the Prince and Princess of Wales earlier that day made their own statement. So again, I would say it's completely unprecedented.
When the King talks about the palace standing ready to help the police, how proactive is that likely to be, and how deep do you think that offer actually runs?
I don't think he would have said it if he didn't mean it. So I think if Thames Valley Police do approach the royal household to see if they can assist in any way with this story, with these allegations, that they will actually cooperate as much as they can with the information that they do know.
The call has come repeatedly for Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to go to the US and to testify or to speak to Congress or to tell people what he knows through his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. To what extent can the King compel Andrew to do that?
That's a very good question. I think Andrew Mountbatten Windsor needs to dig deep and actually think if he does have any information to give to Congress, then he's morally obliged to do so. The King can certainly advise, but I think it is down to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to, again, dig deep and look at his own conscience.
As you were saying, Ailsa, statements like this one are rare. They don't happen all the time. Yes. And one wonders, there's been some heckling of King Charles on public engagements in the last few days. Not a huge amount. We're not talking about crowds of people shouting at him, but there has been some there. And you wonder how much of an impact that might have had on his decision to do this and to release this statement.
Well, I worked for the late Queen for 13 years, and I've never, ever seen her heckled on any public engagement. So for the King to be heckled twice recently, it's really disconcerting for him. And of course, it distracts from the amazing work that the royal family and the King and Queen continue to do for the good of charities and patriots and for UK PLCs. So this is a man who, you know, is trying to concentrate on being monarch. He's still undergoing treatment for cancer. So he's still battling cancer. And this story, this ongoing story, this negativity, the sordidness around this story will clearly have a huge impact on him and the way he's carrying out his public duties. So I think, you know, he wants to draw a line under it, and he wants it to go away, quite rightly so.
Mm. But as you say, your use of the word ongoing there is telling and correct. I mean, there is still more to come out, and that is one of the problems for the royal family. They want to draw that line, but it's going to be very difficult to do.
Absolutely, Anna. And of course, we don't know what else is going to come out, how many more files will be released and what else is in them. So it's incredibly concerning. And as I said, it really does sort of overshadow the amazing work that the monarchy is doing.
Ailsa Anderson, former press secretary to the Queen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It is now 16 minutes past eight. I've won every fight I've been in, Keir Starmer told Labour MPs last night, at the end of a very long day in which there certainly was a big fight, which he appeared to win. But what, if anything, has changed, will now change, to ensure that this crisis isn't simply repeated in the next few days, weeks and months. We're joined on the line by Ed Miliband, former Labour leader, Secretary of State for Energy Security and Net Zero. Morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
I want to explore, if I could, what should happen next, but can we begin by exploring what has just happened? Was there, in your view, an attempted coup against the Prime Minister yesterday? And how close did it come to succeeding?
I think the way I would put it is that Labour MPs looked over the precipice once Anas Sarwar made his statement, and they didn't like what they saw. And they thought the right thing to do was to unite behind Keir, to focus on the country, because we didn't want to go down the road of the Tories, when they were in power, chaotic, disorderly leadership contest. But I want to be very clear with you, Nick. Peter Mandelson should never have been appointed to this post. We are a government whose central purpose, I believe, is to stand up for the powerless, not the powerful, and it undermines that. And this has got to be, as you indicated in your introduction, a moment of change where we have much greater clarity of purpose, avoid some of the mistakes that we've made, but also focus outwards on the country.
So a moment of change. In other words, are you saying that the words of the Scottish Labour leader, Anas Sarwar, are words you can agree with, even if you didn't agree with his conclusion that it should lead to Keir Starmer going? He said, to remind people, they, and he meant Keir Starmer and his team, promised they were going to be different, but too much has happened. He said there have been too many mistakes. The situation is not good enough.
You know, I think Keir would agree with this. Because the truth is that I think the government, our government, is doing lots of good things for the country, whether it's new employment rights or investment in the NHS or what I'm seeking to do, driving forward with clean energy. But it's been drowned out by policy mistakes like winter fuel payment. And, you know, this goes to – I've been in politics a long time, Nick, as have you. What gets you through is a sense of your values and your moral mission. I know why this government was elected, because for 20 years, this country has been run for the wealthy and powerful, not ordinary working people. And the manifestation of that is this long-term cost of living crisis. We exist to change that. That is our mission, and everything must be consistent with that purpose.
I want to come to what that might mean if it is fully pursued. But before we do, let me just raise with you another thing that drowns out what any government wants to do, and that is infighting. Yep. Yesterday, even after Keir Starmer was obviously safe, his people briefed, Wes Streeting was behind all this, and Wes Streeting people briefed against him. Can this, will this, should this stop?
Yes, definitely. Look, all of this is just total distraction, and I think not what the country wants. The country wants us focused on them and the issues that they face, not who's up, who's down, and all of that stuff. So yes.
But Wes has a question that was revealed in the text that he chose to publish yesterday between him and Peter Mandelson to deal with the claim that he was too close to Lord Mandelson. And it's a question I think you know that is asked. There isn't a clear answer to the question, why Labour, he wrote to Peter Mandelson. Now, you've just come up with your answer, a moral mission. The country's run by the wealthy and the powerful. That's not what Keir Starmer's been telling us. One minute he tells us about growth. The next minute he tells us about community. The other minute he tells us it's about the cost of living. I mean, at one stage it's going to be about ID cards. Then it's a crackdown on an island of strangers and immigration. Can he now stick to a single answer to that question for more than a few days at a time?
Yes. And, you know, the Keir I saw last night at the Parliamentary Labour Party was the Keir I know, the private Keir that I've known for 15 years, which is somebody who is motivated by exactly what I described to you. And if the people around him who are his closest friends, and I'm one of his closest friends in politics, have had a frustration, it's that the private Keir we know hasn't been sufficiently on display to the public. And, you know, there were lots of people who went into that meeting last night who were Keir's critics and came out not, you know, actually very, very impressed by what they heard. We need more of that. And I know he recognises that.
And is that because it's not been on display, or because he has chosen to appoint people who don't actually share your moral mission and his? In other words, there are some who are saying, well, look, Peter Mandelson's final passing, as it were, politically, is the end of the new Labour period. Morgan McSweeney, who was a great admirer of Peter Mandelson's way of doing politics, passing, is the end of that. Tim Allard, who used to work for Alistair Campbell and for Tony Blair. This is a moment of change in the Labour Party in which Keir Starmer is going to be unshackled. Is that what you hope and believe?
The way I would characterise it is that, you know, we need people from across the Labour Party as part of the team, a more inclusive team. Look, I famously said that Peter Mandelson deserved dignity in retirement when I was asked whether he would bring him back in 2010. Why did I say that? In part because I thought he was a divisive and factional figure. You know, one of the many reasons I wouldn't have appointed him. I think that factionalism, sectarianism never serves the Labour Party. I think we need the widest possible set of talents across our party. I think there's talent across the Labour Party, and I know Keir recognises that too.
You argued when you were out of office, and forgive me reminding of you, when you lost the general election as leader of the Labour Party,
sure,
that Labour should, in the words of a book you wrote, go big. And you essentially seem to be of the view that Jeremy Corbyn may have had many faults in your mind, but he had been ambitious and he'd captured people's imaginations. And let's remind people, he got more votes than you did. You've admired Mandami, the elected mayor of New York. Are you arguing now that this Labour Party needs to throw off Blairite Mandelsonian ideas of how to win elections and needs to learn a bit from Zach Polanski of the Greens?
What,
needs to be bolder,
I think you're going a bit far.
Merely encouraging you down the route that I think you believe.
Let me go to your point, though. It goes back to this point about the affordability crisis. You know, the reason I wrote that book and I reflected on my time as leader, and I recognised I hadn't been bold enough, because the scale of what we confront as a country, and I think this explains a lot. Since I lost in 2015, you had Brexit, you had Corbyn in 2017, you had 2019, and you now have what people call 5, 6, 7 party politics. Why? Because people are so angry. People think this country is not working for us, and they want boldness in our answers. They want us to meet the scale of what they are facing. Now, it's hard in government, but if what you're asking me, Nick, is should every member of the cabinet, including me, be aspiring to work out how we can go further, faster, to meet that scale of demand for change that people have, 100% I agree with you.
I hear the passion, but there is a question begged by it. What does bold mean? Now, to some people, bold means finally cracking down on illegal migration, cracking down on the huge scale of mass migration. For others, it means welcoming refugees, saying that we as a country benefit. For some, boldness means saying the welfare state is ballooned under your predecessors, but under you too, and you've got to reform it. For others, it says, borrow more money, tax the rich in order to pay. What does it mean?
Sure. Look, boldness rooted in our values. Let me just tell you what I'm doing in my area. Look, we've got really ambitious plans. 2030 clean power, lots of people say we can't do it. We think it is essential for energy security to tackle the climate crisis. And I think stretching your sinews to see how far you can go. And what is it rooted in? Because you named all kinds of things. It's recognising the scale of this cost of living crisis, the scale of the problems the country faces, and the scale of the sense that, look, the way I put it is the philosophies of 3 of the last 4 decades have been trickle-down economics, cut taxes for the rich and everyone else to do better, didn't work, and austerity. Move away from those two ideas with an idea that actually this country has got to be run definitively for ordinary working people. I think that's what I'm doing in my area is all about, creating good, clean energy jobs with strong trade unions. That I think is the kind of boldness that this government is about.
Have you looked like a government of austerity?
No, we haven't, in fact. This is what's so frustrating. We're doing so many good things as a government.
Well, your Labour MPs think you, or many of them think that you have done that.
No,
you've cut welfare,
austerity.
You've cut disability benefits, you've cut benefits for pensioners.
We retreated from all that. But look, in a sense, one of the big frustrations of I'd talked about drowning out earlier on, is that, look, Rachel has raised taxes on the wealthy and business. Some people don't like that. In order that we can invest in the future in public services, including in energy, in health, in education. Look, part of this is about boldness of policy. Part of this is about clarity of narrative, clarity of what we are about. Purpose and values is what gets you through.
Will you forgive me gently pointing out that amongst Keir Starmer's obvious qualities as a public servant, boldness and clear narratives are not even in the top 10?
I think that's just unfair. I mean, look.
But is it? There's not a single Labour MP, there's not a single member of the Cabinet who doesn't, when I meet them, say the man can't tell a story and he can't stick to a decision because he reverses it.
Well, that may be your view, but it's not mine. I know Keir well. I know somebody who is in politics for all the right reasons. I'll tell you what angers Keir most about this country. It's class. It's the class divides. One of the things I've been talking about over a long period is saying more about this. Yes, you said more about it last night because, you know, he exists to change that. I absolutely dispute the idea that this isn't somebody driven by burning passion about the injustices our country faces and how we need to change them. We need more of that. He knows we need more of that. I think we're going to see more of that.
You know the headlines you've just produced, and I'd give you the chance to answer them before they're printed. Class war is the boldness.
Oh, come off it.
No, I'm asking you precisely so that you can spell out if that isn't what it
no,
means.
No, it's not class war.
What does it mean? Well, what is it?
It means that so many people from working class backgrounds are looked down upon in our country, are held back in our country, whether it's from not getting an apprenticeship, not being able to rise up. The inequalities we face hold people back. A Keir is about changing that, not just social mobility for a few, but recognition for everybody, a decent life for everybody. That's what motivates him. Absolute balderdash. Just about class war.
Okay. Well, you've tried to deal with the Daily Mail at least straight away. And just finally, if he concludes that he doesn't have those qualities, boldness, narrative, it's perfectly sane and rational for him to consider his position in a few months' time, isn't it?
He's not going to.
You noted your words very carefully in the tweet that you issued yesterday when all cabinet ministers coincidentally all issued tweets roughly at the same time. Keir has earned the right to deliver the change he has promised. You know, that sounds like a man saying, well, let's give him another go.
No, come off it. Look, he's not going to walk away, as he said last night. He is absolutely in this to lead our party into the next election, to change the country as he firmly and passionately believes in. That's what he is about. He's not walking away.
And if not, if people want a bit of boldness and they want a bit of narrative, I mean, there'll be plenty of people listening to his interview say that Ed Miliband, he's quite good at that stuff, isn't he?
No. I tried that, got the T-shirt. Thanks so much.
Ed Miliband, thank you for trying it with us this morning. Good to talk to you, the Energy and Climate Change Secretary of State.
It is 8:30 and Carthy's back with the sport.
Morning, thank you very much. Fourth place, a rather familiar finish for the great British Winter Olympians yesterday. Kirsty Muir finished in fourth place in the slopestyle final. Mia Brooks just missed out on a podium finish in the snowboard big air final. And Bruce Moat and Jen Dodds lost their mixed curling semi-final 9-3 to Sweden. They go into a bronze medal match today. Lila Fair and Lewis Gibson began their campaign to win a figure skating medal. They are currently also in fourth place. That event concludes tomorrow. The Pakistan government has ended its order on a boycott by its T20 cricket team after a 10-day standoff at the World Cup. Pakistan have now agreed to play India, a game that is the commercial centrepiece of the tournament. Bangladesh, though, are boycotting the tournament, citing safety concerns amid growing tensions between Bangladesh and India. Their place at the T20 World Cup was handed to Scotland just 2 weeks ago. And we can speak to the CEO of Cricket Scotland, Trudy Limblade. Thanks for joining us, Trudy. It's a unique situation. Where were your cricketers when they found out, and how quickly did they all get to the World Cup?
Hi, Cathy. It certainly was a unique situation. So, you know, we were watching the media to see what would happen. And obviously, you know, nobody wants to see a team boycott a World Cup. But when the invitation did come to us, we had players all around the world from, you know, Scotland and London to Australia, Malaysia and South Africa. So literally getting everybody from all corners of the globe to India within 7 days was something that you wouldn't necessarily say you could do, but we can prove, we have proved you can.
Well, how challenging was that just from the logistics point of view? Visas, presumably, tournament shirts, everything behind the scenes. How did you do it?
Yeah, so we had, I suppose when you want to do something, you can. So because we'd been sort of watching what was going on, I brought a little group together and we did some contingency planning for if we did get the call up in that unlikely event that we would, and which obviously turned into likely. So we thought about shirts. We couldn't do anything about visas, and we thought about how we would go about it, how we'd select players, how we would just make this happen. So we didn't start from zero, which I think definitely helped us getting to where we got to. Plus the ICC put a specific person with us to just make sure we got everybody there in the quickest possible time. So there was everybody rallying behind the scenes, from people in consulates to from India to Nepal to Scotland to London, and we made it happen.
It sounds incredibly complicated. Financially, though, how much of a boost is this, or has the logistics part of it actually taken quite a lot of finances just to get there?
So there is definitely a financial boost when you're competing in a World Cup, and that particularly a World Cup in India that has the coverage that we that cricket gets globally. So yes, there's a direct financial benefit, which does go onto logistics and into the tournament and preparation, but it's that wider benefit of that engagement piece. So people knowing that Scottish cricket is actually a terrific sport and we compete on the world stage against the best.
And you were the 14th ranked team in the world. That's part of the reason, as in the next team that was supposed to be at the World Cup, which is part of the reason why you got that call up. So far, you have had a match against Windies and that was a defeat, a win against Italy. What is the target, knowing it was such a last minute call up?
I think that's the thing. Because it was a last minute, the expectations on us was low. We've had 7 days to prepare for a tournament that other teams have 6 months for. So we've been really pleased with our performances so far. We, of course, want to get through to the Super 8s. We're a professional team. We want to play our best and do the best we can in the tournament. So we'll keep going through the matches. We've got England on Saturday on Valentine's Day, Calcutta Cup. So, you know, we'll be there ready to play against England and do the best we can, and with an eye on the Super 8s.
And presumably you have a bit of sympathy for Bangladesh. They're citing safety concerns. I know the ICC are saying that there aren't any, but to have to pull out of a World Cup and to have a World Cup without Bangladesh there, it makes the tournament poor. Doesn't it?
It's a really difficult and unique set of circumstances, and it's one that, you know, obviously we've seen the ICC and Bangladesh working through amongst others. So for us, it's about just focusing on the tournament at hand and doing the best we can do. But equally, our players and us, all of us at Cricket Scotland, certainly feel for the Bangladesh players.
Well, good luck next game against England, as you mentioned. Trudy Lindblad, CEO of Cricket Scotland, thank you for joining me. And just to mention, football and Middlesbrough are top of the Championship after beating 10-man Sheffield United 2-1 last night. No reason why I'm mentioning that at all, is there,
Anna? That will go down well in the
I live in a Middlesbrough supporting household. And while you can say that, it's worth we can save it for posterity for the future.
Yes, let's cut it out. Put it on the wall in that way. I've been meaning to ask you, Arthur, what happened to Lindsay Vonn after that terrible crash she had?
She terrible, really terrible. Complex tibia fracture, I think, is the injury. 41 years old, she will now require multiple surgeries, and that was her fifth Olympics that she was trying to compete in. She's already a champion from 2010, but she said no regrets at all for trying to compete.
Mm. She's like the knight in the Monty Python film, isn't she? It's just a flesh wound. She says, now, I'll stop waffling about skiing and tell you about what's happening every afternoon this week here on Radio 4 when Professor Giles Yeo explores our appetite for weight loss drugs.
I'm no longer ravenous. I'm no longer desperate. I'll no longer eat until I fall asleep and I have to rest.
The Hunger Game, a new 5-part series exploring the meteoric rise of weight loss drugs.
It's been an incredible story with these drugs. The uptake, the amount of product that's been sold, the amount of money it's cost, the amount of money that's been made.
What the drugs do, how they work, and the knock-on effects of their widespread use.
People are having to completely alter the way they do business.
The Hunger Game with me, Professor Giles Yeo. This Monday to Friday, lunchtime at 1:45. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
The weather today will be cloudy. There's a chance of brightness around, but some drizzle this morning and patchy rain developing later in the day.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson at 24 minutes to 9. Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer will chair a meeting of his cabinet this morning after telling last night's meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party that he wouldn't give up his mandate. Senior Labour MPs rallied to support the Prime Minister yesterday when the leader of Scottish Labour, Anna Sarwar, called for him to step aside. The Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, told us this must be a moment of change for Labour. He said the government was doing lots of good things that were being drowned out by policy mistakes, and its mission must be to run the country for ordinary working people rather than the rich and powerful. Buckingham Palace says it stands ready to support police if asked about the conduct of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Officers are assessing claims the King's brother shared confidential reports with the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has been approached for comment. The press secretary to the late Queen, Elsa Anderson, told us the statement from the palace was unprecedented and showed the anxiety in the royal household.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 23 minutes to nine. Vice chancellors from more than 70 universities have been briefed behind closed doors by intelligence chiefs about the threat of foreign interference amid efforts by countries like China and Russia to try and get more information from them. This was from the MI5 Director General, Sir Ken McCallum, and Richard Horne, who is the National Cybersecurity Centre's chief executive. And they were talking to vice chancellors about methods used by hostile actors to influence research and teaching content. Well, Michelle Shipworth is an associate professor at UCL. The university removed a module from her after complaints were raised by Chinese students.
My own experience was that I had a teaching module taken away from me because I had a Chinese student complain about a 10-year-old teaching exercise. And instead of standing up to the student, my university has given in to the student's demand. And I'm fairly sure that that student was backed by the Chinese Students and Scholars Association, because the sort of material that I was teaching, which was teaching students to be critical thinkers, is the sort of skill set that the Chinese Communist Party does not want its students to have. So now there are no students on that course learning how to do that sort of critical thinking skill, which is teaching them how to critique secondary data and factual claims.
Well, a UCL spokesperson told us an external investigation was undertaken into the concerns raised by Professor Shipworth, and it would be, they said, inappropriate to comment on individual cases, but that they would never accept or tolerate inappropriate influence. We're joined by Sir Peter Matheson, who's the Vice-Chancellor at the University of Edinburgh, also the lead for Universities UK and the Russell Group on international security issues in relation to universities. Sir Peter, good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
Do you know if your university, the University of Edinburgh, has been targeted by China or Russia?
We don't have any evidence of that. We just keep a constant vigil for interference by any overseas nation. And I think one of the missions of the meeting that you referred to in your introduction is just to try and make sure that all universities are aware of how much we are a target and what we can do about it.
Do you think you're monitoring or able to monitor deeply enough to know?
There's a very good awareness at leadership level, I think, in universities now, especially over the last 4 or 5 years. There's been a lot of work done to try and raise awareness. We are still concerned about how much that permeates down through what is always a large and complex sort of devolved organisation like a British university. So training and education for early career staff, very much part of our approach, trying to make sure that everyone understands not only that there are risks, but also how can they react to those risks and importantly, where can they get advice from?
We know that universities across the board have financial concerns, and one of the places to recruit students from and get higher fees is overseas. And in fact, a few years ago, you were talking to the university's general counsel about how Chinese applications had risen sharply since you were appointed in 2018. And your university has not far off the same number of students from China as you do from Scotland and England. So it's not really something you can cut off. Do you monitor those students? Do you vet those students? How does it work?
So all of that's correct. We do have a lot of Chinese students in Edinburgh, and most British universities have a lot of overseas students. And in many cases, China is the single biggest contributor to that population. There is an underlying financial imperative, which you refer to. So universities are in financial difficulty, and one source of increased income is from taking international students because they pay higher tuition fees than home students. There are lots of other reasons for having international students. They diversify the experience for home students, and they provide international links for the universities to kind of spread their effect all over the world. So there's lots and lots of reasons. It's true that the Chinese numbers in Edinburgh and other universities have increased. And these students are very high quality students. They they work hard, they speak excellent English, and they're generally very good students to have. But we all want to diversify our international student population so that we're not too dependent on any one country, because that's not, frankly, in the best interest of those students either, in the sense that we want them to have a truly international experience, not be surrounded by a number of people speaking the same language from the same country. They want to get more diversity as well. So that's very much a goal for us. But the reality is, right now, British universities are very dependent on Chinese students.
Yeah, and it does increase your exposure, and particularly as hackers, state-sponsored hackers, become more sophisticated, it will become harder and harder to try and make sure that they're not infiltrating universities like yours.
Well, indeed, and state-sponsored hackers are very sophisticated. They don't necessarily need students from their country to be at a particular place in order to infiltrate that place. So we are aware of cyber risk. I think one of the missions that the security services have had in the last few years is to make universities aware of just how attractive they are as targets. So I think we sometimes underestimate how significant we are as targets for foreign interference. And it's a compliment, actually, to British universities. It's a sign of how highly regarded we are internationally and what interesting work we do, the fact that other people are interested to know more about it.
So Peter Matheson, Vice-Chancellor at the University of Edinburgh, thank you.
Coming up to 17 minutes to nine. Time now to hear from another of Britain's best-known authors, reading from the book that ignited or reignited their love of reading. We've been doing this, as you will know, for a very long time, because we're marking the National Year of Reading, focused on getting more people of all ages reading for pleasure. It's the turn this morning of Cressida Cowell, author of the best-selling How to Train Your Dragon series, which spawned the popular animated films. And she's chosen The Joy Luck Club by Amy Tan, first published in the UK in 1989 by Heinemann.
I've chosen The Joy Luck Club by Amy Tan. I reread all the time. I mean, I reread my favourite books all the time, and I've reread this so often. I had to get a new copy because it fell apart. I read it initially because I had taught in China, actually, when I was a very young woman. And when I went out there in sort of 1985, 1986, I had no idea of Chinese recent history. So this book was personally very exciting for me because I was learning about history at the same time as reading a wonderful story. And it shed a lot of light on my own experience in China. The Joy Luck Club is the story of four Chinese women who emigrate to America and their four daughters who grew up in America. And it begins with June, who's one of the daughters, whose mother's just died, and she's invited to join the Mahjong table in her mother's place. And this is the daughter talking about a story that her mother told her about what happened before she left China. By then, I didn't have enough feeling left in my body to cry. I tied scarves into slings and put a baby on each side of my shoulder. I carried a bag in each hand, one with clothes, the other with food. I carried these things until deep grooves grew in my hands, and I finally dropped one bag after the other when my hands began to bleed and became too slippery to hold on to anything. Along the way, I saw others had done the same, gradually given up hope. It was like a pathway inlaid with treasures that grew in value along the way. Bolts of fine fabric and books, paintings of ancestors and carpenter tools, until one could see cages of ducklings now quiet with thirst, and later still, silver urns lying in the road where people had been too tired to carry them for any kind of future hope. By the time I arrived in Chungking, I had lost everything except for three fancy silk dresses, which I wore one on top of the other. In this book, because it's so beautifully constructed, like a Mahjong table, you get each chapter a different perspective. So the mother's stories and then the daughter's stories. And it's different ways of viewing the relationship. And you see, you know, these mothers and these daughters often have difficulty communicating with each other, but the different chapters allow you into the minds and the histories, the stories of these very different characters who've grown up in very different worlds. It shows what books can do, what I feel books can do. They allow you, they take you into the experience, into the mind of somebody else, more powerfully than anything else. When you reread books, you get, if they're a really good book, you get something new and something different out of them every single time you reread. I think a lot of people do this if I'm ill or seeking reassurance or a reminder of myself of the wisdom that a certain book gave me. I'll go back to that book, a bit like talking to an old friend.
That was Cressida Cowell, the author of How to Train Your Dragon, talking and about and reading from The Joy Luck Club by AB Tan.
It's 14 minutes to nine. Israel's security cabinet has approved new steps to increase its control over the occupied West Bank, giving it new powers in terms of property law, planning, licensing and enforcement as well. Bezalel Smotrich, the far-right Israeli finance minister, said, "We will continue to kill the idea of a Palestinian state." The UN says that last year, Israeli settlements in the West Bank expanded at their fastest rate since monitoring began. Well, Jeremy Bowen is our international editor and joins us this morning. Jeremy, what impact will this have?
Well, what this is the continuation of a policy that the current Israeli government has of creeping annexation of the occupied West Bank. That's a violation of international law. The International Court of Justice has ruled that the entire occupation is anyway illegal. And the things that they are trying to do, the changing of laws, is a violation of a number of international laws, but the Israelis are not bothered about that. And as you said, that Mr. Smotrich, who's the sort of driving force behind this in the cabinet, who's been sanctioned by the UK for inciting violence, and he is a very hardline settler leader who believes that all of that territory is Jewish territory and should be part of the State of Israel. So that's very much their position. Britain, of course, has recognized an independent Palestinian state. So I know that Britain has already, along with many other countries, condemned this move by the Israelis. But the question is whether Britain does anything else about this. I know that speaking to, you know, over the month, senior Palestinian officials, they say things like, well, if Britain thinks we should be independent, then, you know, they need to do a little bit more than say that they condemn these moves when they happen.
Which chimes exactly with what Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, has said yesterday. He's called for the US, for the UN Security Council to intervene immediately. But can they intervene? What might that even look like?
Well, President Trump has also said that he's against the annexation of the West Bank. And that has been since this announcement came out. I mean, the question is whether any Western countries, and not just Western countries, but particularly the United States, would consider perhaps sanctions, as they might do with other countries, if there was a violation of international law. I would say that that's probably pretty much unlikely. So, I mean, at the moment, the Israelis, I think the Israeli government feels, well, these guys can say what they want because we will continue doing what we want to do here because we're in charge of the whole thing. And that anyway, the idea of a Palestinian state is a nonsense because that's the point that they have made many times, not just Bezalel Smotrich, but other members of the government as well. And Prime Minister Netanyahu himself has said many times that he's absolutely against a Palestinian state because it would be a security risk to the State of Israel, that they would have more 7th of October-style attacks. The counter-argument to that is that the reason why attacks have happened is because of the fact that this conflict has continued for more than 100 years, and until that there is some kind of a political settlement, it will continue again. Netanyahu himself is, of course, going to Washington, so maybe this will come up. He's flying today, and that might come up perhaps in his conversations with Donald Trump, but I think Netanyahu wants to talk about Iran.
Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, thank you.
It is time now at 10 to 9. To turn to a movie described as hot, bosom-heaving, gasp-inducing, a thrill ride with lashings of kinky sex. Disgusting. Those are just some of the words used in the headlines of reviews of the new adaptation of Wuthering Heights, the Warner Brothers movie starring Jacob Elordi as Heathcliff and Margot Robbie as Catherine Earnshaw.
Why did you leave me?
Why did you betray your own heart?
Well, as you can hear, it's a low-key, faithful adaptation of the original novel. Leila Latif has been watching it for us. The film critic writes for The Guardian, amongst other papers. Leila, it recently seems to have divided the critics. I'm just looking at some of the headlines in different papers. I read out some of the words, but some give it 5 stars, some give it 2.
Yes, no, I mean, it's one of the... Emerald Fennell, I think, is generally quite a director that tends to polarise people. Some people loved Saltburn, some people loved Promising Young Woman, and other people were completely put off by it. I think, you know, if nothing else, it's great to have a young British director who stirs conversation.
And stirs conversation with all those words I just read out. I mean, the whole point is presumably to get people who would not normally watch an adaptation of Wuthering Heights into the cinema, not just because of the stars, but because of, frankly, what they do in the film.
Yes. I mean, I guess it kind of depends how easily titillated you are. I mean, for me, I wasn't that shocked. I mean, maybe because I watched, you know, a big breadth of cinema and, like, you know, a heaving bosom doesn't make me weak at the knees. Great if that's something that, you know, gets you excited.
But what about the other possibility, which is it leaves you saying, yuck? I mean, The Guardian review calls it too hot and too greedy. The Daily Mail says there's lashings of kinky sex, but it's less Wuthering Heights, more 50 Shades of Grimm.
Well, I mean, I think they need to grow up, really. I mean, sex is a part of these lusty stories, and it's perfectly fine to portray that. And I don't think it really is that kind of outrageous to have that as part of this story. I don't think it's actually as shocking as they are suggesting. And I'm quite surprised by people that are outraged by it.
But the test is, would you say to a loved one or a friend who's got a Saturday evening coming up, yeah, go to that. That's the film. Is it one of those, or is it not really?
I would say this is not going to kind of blow your artistic, mind. You're not going to come away with some profound new appreciation of Wuthering Heights. But it's very pretty. It's very horny. And, you know, it's a decent time at the movies. Yeah. You know, but I don't think it's going to go down as one of the great literary adaptations for sure.
Leila Latif, thank you very much indeed.
Can you hear that? That's the sound of cornflakes being choked on up and down the land at breakfast tables at 9:07.
Let us end the programme this morning by reflecting on what just happened. Now, Ed Miliband described it to us as the Labour Party looking over the precipice and not liking what it saw. So the question is whether this coup is over or has merely been postponed. And then what next? Ed Miliband clearly arguing that Keir Starmer needs to be himself, needs to break free, as some of his MPs put it, needs to be, it sounded to me like, more authentically left-wing. Well, let's reflect on that. With a man who used to advise Tony Blair many years ago, John McTernan, knows what it's like inside Downing Street. Danny Finkelstein did a similar job for John Major many, many years ago as Times columnist and political commentator too. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
John, over or postponed?
Oh, postponed.
Till?
Till we see whether the Prime Minister can use this time. You've had a great operation from Number 10 yesterday, getting the cabinet ministers out. You saw a great operation to use the fire extinguisher on Anas Sarwar, the Scottish Labour leader. But you got space. What are you going to do with it? And I think you have to burn up the road. You have to do small things like ban smartphones in school, big things like actually get a grip of housing. You've got to use your authority, your majority, and your manifesto. And Ed was right. The Labour Party was elected on a very radical manifesto on housing, on planning, on infrastructure, on the green transition. This needs to be turned into an industrial strategy. It needs to be turned into a coherent story. It needs to be a very clear political economy. All the things there, and the most popular things the government are doing are the soft left things. So Keir needs to go back to his left wing instincts.
I'm hearing that phrase, Danny Finkelstein, from the West Wing. Let Starmer be Starmer. Do you think it's going to work?
Yeah, I think the idea is actually to let Starmer be Ed Miliband. If you let Starmer be Starmer, it's not obvious what that is. Obviously, what I think, and it's perfectly coherent, this, is that the government's going to become less what I want it to be. But I'm a Conservative peer, so it's hardly surprising that it would choose to do that. It's The departure of Morgan McSweeney is very politically consequential. I've often felt that there was a misfit between who the Labour Party actually is, what it sort of has developed to become, and what it kind of romantically thinks it is, and that Morgan McSweeney represented what it romantically thought it was, a pitch to working class voters as a Labourist movement with a socialist undertone, and he was trying to pursue that using strategies developed together with Peter Mandelson. That combination, I think, wasn't either naturally, didn't naturally fit together, and it wasn't Keir Starmer's political instinct. So now that he is gone, there's definitely a chance to reset the government, but I don't think it'll come from Keir Starmer's instincts. I think it'll come from, you know, from John McTurnan's and Ed Miliband's, where the Labour Party's heart really is.
Which means, does it, John McTurnan, less obsession with the red wall, less obsession with what reform UK voters want, and does it mean forming what some in the past have called a progressive alliance, bringing together the left?
So it's about remembering who our core voters are. Labour's core voters are white-collar professionals, graduates under 40, who live in cities. Labour's core voters are black and Muslim voters in cities all across England. Our core voters are the ones we've been neglecting in pursuit of. I think it's 2% of reform voters say they'd ever consider voting Labour. A third of people who've defected, you know, we've lost half our votes since 2024. A third of the people who've gone from Labour to Lib Dems or the Greens or the Nationalists, they say they would look at Labour again if Labour actually was clearer about being close to Europe, clearer about the green transition, clearer. So I think, yes, go back to our core vote, our real one, not our imaginary one.
Daddy Finkelstein, there are Labour people, aren't there, who say, look, the real threat is Polanski, the Green leader, not Farage, the Reform UK leader.
Well, it depends who Labour wants to be. John was very articulate. He described exactly what I think the Labour Party is going to try and do now. It's coherent. It's not what I want. I wonder whether it's a big enough coalition. It is if the right is completely split. It isn't if the right is not split, as Ed Miliband discovered in 2015. So we'll have to see whether it works out. But that is, you know, you're just hearing from John, I think, a pretty cogent description of what Labour will try now that Ed Miliband isn't there. And, you know, Keir Starmer isn't there. It is, after all, you know, it makes some sense, this strategy, if you've got a Kentish Town human rights lawyer as your leader. That made no sense accompanied by the strategy that Morgan McSweeney was doing, which is why Keir Starmer always had to keep on saying that he was the son of a toolmaker.
Yeah, with seconds to go, in a year's time, is Keir Starmer still Prime Minister, John First?
In a year's time, Labour will still be the government.
Interesting choice of words. Lord Finkelstein?
I don't think so. I think 70%, 80% chance he's not.
So this is a moment, but it wasn't the... Yeah, interesting. Anna, there's been a lot of commentary. I've been looking at Twitter that journalists have got in too much of a froth. It's all been hyperbole. Not a single guest